Run through the framework framework in some detail, and we can take questions as and when members need further clarification. So thank you, Chair. Just for members who don't have copies of the documentation, I believe we've been surprised by the interest in this particular presentation. Our colleagues at the Parliamentary Office will bring a few more copies of the documentation in the coming few minutes. So in your fact share, you should have a copy of our presentation this morning and a copy of the NCS guidelines which we issued to the department in June 2007. And what we're going to do is to just briefly discuss the content of the document. Just for your information, we're not going to talk much about provinces, but the way the guidelines are structured, it deals with NCES budgets in such as the deals with salary, wage negotiations, continuous efforts on improving program structures, and I'll talk to that. Some specific initiatives that we want to highlight, for instance, the framework for managing program performance information. We talk about capital budgeting, conditional grants, and then finally we have a chapter that deals with provincial specific issues. As you know, there are sometimes slight differences with provinces on concurrent functions, and the kind of guidance we wish to give them might contain slight or different emphasis to what we want for national departments. So the document is very applicable to national and provincial government, but we want to emphasize particular provincial reforms. To the extent that we needed to do that, we included a separate chapter at the end of the guidelines. I will just, for the purposes of today, talk about the national department in the NCS. So we'll talk a little bit about the strategic plans of the department and how that fits into the NCS. I will try and highlight the 2008 budget process, the one that we're about to embark on. I'll give you some of the highlights contained in the document. There's a lot of detail there, and I'm not sure we could have to set the kind of the level of detail which members might require, and perhaps we need to do some further reading and we can deal with questions once you're more familiar with the content. We'll talk in detail about the framework for managing program performance information and how that relates to the government-wide monitoring and evaluation framework. And then we'll just make a few concluding remarks on in-year monitoring information that's previously been requested and discussed with the Joint Budget Committee, and we'll allow an opportunity for questions. If you'll allow me, members, I thought it might be useful if we start off with a very simple example of how the NCS works. And I created a very fictional police department. It obviously cannot be South Africa because I don't think on 100 drive we could achieve anything. But just to illustrate some of the concepts that we're trying to explain in terms of the NCS guidelines. So the first two slides, if it's all very familiar and new to you, I apologize, but I thought it might be useful to just remind ourselves what the NCS is really about and how the resource envelope is determined at the end of the day. So, supposing we have a three-year NCS, which is the case in South Africa, we call it a rolling three-year budget process, and we've assumed that there are 5,500 employees, and we've given them allocation of 100 rand in 2016, or year one, 105 and 106 rand in the third year. So those are the fictional allocations we've come up with. Now, for the next year, we started with 100 for 2007 budget. We say we're giving 105 and 110. Those are what we call the baseline figures for police. In order to determine the third year of the NCS, then, we would do it in terms of an inflationary adjustment initially. There are other considerations that I'll talk about a little bit later. But let's say arbitrarily we give them a 6% adjustment, and then the new NCS will now be 105, 110, and 116 for 2009-10. I hope we all follow that. So this is what they are getting, and that is guaranteed. But now they have to bid for extra resources over the baseline. The numbers I've given you are what we call their baseline. So is there additional priority, for instance, if there are some of the programs that are not performing well, etc., or, you know, we have new priorities like the 2010 World Cup, where we think safety and security is an important thing, and we need new resources. They need to then submit budget bids to the Treasury and justify the additional amount. And this is what the MTS guidelines are basically about. So let's say in the new budget, we agree with police that they need extra money, that the 105, 110, and 116 rand are not enough. We give them an additional 5 rand, 10 rand, and 20 rand when they need the MTS committee, which I'll talk about a little later, and we agree that they need the resources. It then means that the new budget increases to 110 rand in 2007-8, 120 rand in 2008-9, and 136 rand in 2009-10. And then the Minister of Finance will typically add the 5, 10, and 20 rand, and in the budget speech, he will say that we've given the police 35 rand additional money over the baseline. So in each budget, the point we're trying to make is that only a small part of the total spending, the additional money, is subject to active decision making. You've seen the example that the 105 and 110 and 116 rand were guaranteed. They're getting that based on the assumptions that we've made and the budget for previous year. They have to motivate for additional money, and that is what I was trying to illustrate through this example. We then have what is called a medium term expenditure committee, or MTEC. Officials from the National Treasury, the DDG of the Budget Office, the DDG of Public Finance, and for concurrent functions we include the DDG for Intergovernmental Relations, and various other experts, as well as members of the Presidency, DPLG, and depending on the issues under discussion, the members of MTEC might have additional committee members, but those are the basic ones. So they will then listen to the budget proposal of this fictitious police department. They will cross-examine them on their administrative plans and implementation plans. Obviously, in that kind of meeting, it spans over a period of 2 to 3 weeks or a month, depending on the departments that are being seen by the National Treasury. They will try to determine the motivation for the funding, whether there's capacity to implement, whether, you know, the department has done some cost-benefit analysis prior to implementing a capital project, project management skills, etc. And they will examine and interrogate the numbers to make sure that the costing has been done according to plan, that they have the HR, the resources, etc., etc. So this happens round about now. In fact, we're about to start it from next week. And the national departments, as I say, will run a process to allocate resources between departments. Provinces have their own MTEC processes, and they will then decide how to allocate resources at the provincial level. We always ask departments to interrogate the baseline to absorb new priorities. So we don't simply assume that if there are new priorities, they should get new money. We first say, well, what savings can you identify in your current budget? What amounts have been underspent? Do you think your planning and costing for the past year was efficient and optimal, you know, before you ask us for new money? And then we evaluate the budget submission. MTEC, as I said, listens to the department's presentation and asks very tough questions, because the culture is always to ask for new money. We know that if we don't spend what's been given to us, we run the risk of losing it next year. So we sometimes spend it on the wrong things, and this is where I think Parliament, you know, plays a very critical role in its oversight. And then we will try and determine whether the priorities are in line with the department's strategic plan, first of all, in line with government's broader priorities on a macro level, and whether the budget programs have been structured in terms of those priorities. National Treasury or MTEC will then make recommendations to the Ministers' Committee on the Budget. which we refer to as Mincombat, and then Mincombat, which consists of senior ministers, of members of cabinet, together with the Minister of Finance, will then make decisions which are taken to cabinet for approval. So what are we doing for the 2008 NDF? We examined the budget bit. We determined the resource envelope. We'll see how much money we have available, what we need to borrow, how much revenue we're going to generate. We have the MTEC discussion. And for this year, I should just emphasize, as in the past, we're focusing very much on cluster priorities. And you'll appreciate that in certain clusters like the JCPS cluster, which is Department of Correctional Services, Justice, SAPS, etc., the cluster priorities are easier to determine, because you'll appreciate that when you have a suspect or a person who's suspected of a crime, they first have to be arrested by the police and then go to court and ultimately to prison if they're found guilty. So in that particular cluster, it's important to focus on cluster priorities. But we do, as a matter of course, ask the social development cluster chairs, etc., to present on cluster priorities to ensure that we align the strategic plans of departments. If you don't have this planning in a vacuum where housing does one thing, doesn't know what's important to local government, etc. And so I've mentioned the cluster priorities and the examination of cross-cutting issues, which will receive focus and attention in this year. So MTEC will not see one department and ask them about their budget priorities. They will say, well, to the Department of Education, have you spoken to the 9 provinces? And in fact, the format recently has allowed the heads of department of the 9 provincial departments of education to join the MTEC discussion when the National Department of Education is presenting their MTF budget. But the same would go for the health, etc., and the other provincial departments. And just to emphasize again, Chair, we think, as I said when I started, we value this opportunity to engage with the community. We strengthen, we want to emphasize the importance of parliamentary oversight in 3-year allocations, particularly, in terms of the outer years. What I've just explained to you in our fictional example is that certain amounts are guaranteed. And there's always an incentive to try and get new money, to bite off more than you can chew, instead of focusing on existing priorities. And in order to get extra money, the tendency is often to come up with new, interesting things which you think will guarantee some kind of funding, instead of focusing on your core mandate and, allocating the resources to accelerating existing programs. And I think this is an important issue for the committee to examine in your oversight. And then, as we all know, the medium-term budget policy statement, or MTBPS, will signal major policy decisions for the 2008 budget.
I thought we have questions of clarity, not just so that we are clarified in the process.
No.
We are not? Okay, when we say programs, but when you say programs, we are referring to the standard programs that appear in the ENE of each and every department. Those are the programs, like admin and whatever else.
Absolutely. Okay. Let me just clarify that. Those are the ENE programs. So program 1 is typical for administration, salary of ministers, HR, and so forth. Those are the programs I'm talking about. Correct. Thank you. Thanks for that question. I thought it might be useful if I just shared with you some of the critical budget lines. These are the timelines that we have to hold ourselves to ensure that the budget is delivered on time and to ensure that we do justice to the allocation processes in India, which are published in the Treasury guidelines. Now, the MTF guidelines, and I didn't mention this up front, is complemented by a very complicated database. So the numbers have to substantiate the bids. I didn't bring an example of that to this meeting, because I think it's very technical. What really needs to go into detail to understand that. But we issued that together with the guidelines and the letter to the Chief Financial Officer and the Director General in the department. We try and target this for, you know, sort of end of May, early June, and often because of other processes that we follow within the Treasury, we're not as good as sticking to the deadline, but in general, by the earliest first week of June, we try and issue this to all departments. And we have an information session as well, where we invite representatives from each of the 34 votes represented in the E&E, where we explain to them what our expectations are. We try not to be too rigid and structured, but we encourage departments to be innovative in their budget, but not to just comply with a letter and have the numbers in a particular format in a box. It's really about substantiating the request for additional funding. So we have that in June when we issue the guidelines. Because the infrastructure capital budgeting is more complicated, there are lots of issues to consider with capital budgets, and we've got a very professional technical team at the Treasury who assesses these, but we normally request that those are submitted earlier. They will feed into that's the quote. For emphasis.
Are you saying that when you provide the guidelines or the four boards, the DGs or CFOs, are they, you don't just send them to the department, they are they go through those guidelines to them so that they can get an understanding of what the guidelines and priorities are?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes. What we normally do is, we first email the guidelines to everybody so that they can read it. We give them a few days to just read the content so that they can bring questions to the information session. We then schedule a morning session in Pretoria. I can't remember the date this year, so you know. It was sometime in early June, maybe the 2nd or 3rd of June, I think, under correction. We then invite the Chief Financial Officers, because they're responsible for coordinating the bids of the department. And any other people, we normally invite about two or three representatives per department to the session. So we then run through a presentation with them. We show them what's required in terms of the database. And we allow for questions of clarifications and general discussion on the content of the guidelines. They usually complain, you know, that Treasury's requests are too onerous and so on. But we allow them and try and engage with them. We then also have individual sessions per department where it's required. And those are led by the budget analyst in public finance. So for example, if the JCPS cluster wanted a separate briefing for more staff than we could accommodate at the initial briefing, we would have a separate meeting. And we have invitations where Robert and myself or other officials from the budget office would go and present to departments, either at their strategic plan meetings, at EXCO, etc., on the MCES guidelines. And we open and flexible to do it at any venue. Robert, for instance, went to Durban to do one of these presentations. Okay, I should just give a minute for everybody to get. Mr. Kanani, you are interrupting the meeting. Yeah, but you're disrupting the meeting. Thank you, Chairperson. And I'll show you at the end. We also publish the guidelines on our website. So any person who didn't manage to attend any of the sessions or who wasn't available can go to the website and download the guidelines, the framework for performance information, and the presentation if they wanted to make it to a wider group within the department or other officials who are responsible. And what we expect, we don't typically invite the entities to these meetings because we host them in the budget council room. And we normally have about 300 or so people attending, so we're limited for space, but that's why we have the flexibility of presenting to departments or their public entities if there's a request. But we then expect the department to go out and engage the entities on the requirements in terms of the budget. But The infrastructure funding request then, because of the complexity, are required to be submitted earlier than the budget bit. And they, I've given you some idea in July and August on MINCOM budget and the cabinet report meeting, which you're all familiar with. Then the budget submissions are due on the 10th of August. And that should be a composite submission. It needs to include the budget bit of the department and any of its entities or agencies. So we cannot simply look at, you know, Department of Public Enterprises, for example, if we don't have the request, funding request of the entities. This is the idea for the deadline. Then there are several Budget Council and MINCOM meetings, and as I mentioned, the MTEC discussions are about to kick off now. On Monday, we'll have the first discussion, which is chaired by the DGs of the particular clusters, where they will present on cluster priorities. So when the MTEC committee then goes and looks at the budget submissions in detail, they will examine that in relation to the priorities of the cluster. And in some it's easier. You will agree with me that perhaps with some of the administrative clusters, it doesn't make as much sense to look at cluster priorities there, but we have to look at overlap and congruence anyway. The extended cabinet approval of the division of revenue is then considered in October. The MCDCS will be tabled on the 30th of October, and the budget date is scheduled for the 27th of February next year. What I forgot to mention, Chair, is that MTEC also looks at the division of revenue between the three spheres. So some cross-cutting function discussions, what we call 10x10s and 4x4s and so on the sectoral priorities happen prior to MTEC. Those will feed in, and then MTEC will also look at the, we call it the vertical division between the three spheres, what the priorities are for national government vis-a-vis provinces, vis-a-vis local government, and ensure that that split also takes into account the priorities. So I'll explain to you now what we mean by baseline. Baseline is where we started off. It was the 100, 100, 510 example. Because there's a lot of once-off projects or projects with a finite lifetime. Let's take 2010 for example. We're planning for 2010 for the World Cup, but after that, it's more the projects or budgets are more of a maintenance nature rather than construction. So you have in the Department of Sport, for example, big allocations leading up to 2010 and following that. You need to strip out those allocations when you examine your baseline and say, these projects have been concluded, they're no longer relevant, so let's examine our budget bits, you know, in line with a non-recurrent expenditure is what we call it. Recurrent expenditure would be salaries and wages, you know, the ongoing cost to continue running the department. So we remove non-recurrent expenditure and then we get a more realistic number when we add that inflationary adjustment to determine what we think the department's allocation should be, and they will of course come back and ask for more. It seldom happens that they said, you know what, we have enough, don't give us any more. I have yet to see that. The budget structures are very important, and we spoke about the E&E a little bit earlier, because departments are supposed to design their budget structures or the programs to give effect to their priorities in the strategic plan. So if a particular program is focused on a priority that's important, some service delivery objectives and targets that haven't been met or that are significant department of a department strategy, you would expect the resource allocation to reflect that. So we look at those program structures, and what often happens, and please stop me if I'm too technical, is whenever there's a personnel change, human resources, we move people from one to the other, people think they should change their budget practice. And we're saying that is not what it's about. You can have people doing the same work, but make sure that your budget structures are aligned to the strategy and that the resources are allocated according to the budget, the program for a particular budget.
Just a question, please. What's the connection between ODA and the RDP fund? Is it such things under ODA or is it the other way around?
Well,
That's what I was just about to get to that. How the official development assistance is donor funding. That's the plain understanding for it. So any funding we get from, you know, a donor, say the Irish Aid, the European Union, from CEDA, the Canadian government, USAID, you name it. Many departments get additional resources for specific programs to fund some of the, you know, the activities that they have. And what we're trying to do is to look at what they're getting from elsewhere, because what they do, they consider that soft money, easy money. You don't really have to account for it in the same way as you do for the other allocations. So this year we've asked departments to very transparently show per program. And you can see with the Department of Education, for those of you who are familiar with the E&E, we usually publish long tables of donor assistance, but it's per project. And it's very difficult to determine what impact it has or which programs it's relevant to. So this is a reform we've introduced this year as well. We've said, if you are getting funding from an external source, from a donor in cash, tell us what it is so that we can look at that as well and look at the performance against the official development assistance or donor funding. And when Robert talks to the performance information framework, you'll see that we're looking at, you know, non-financial information for all funding, including, you know, donor assistance. On the 2010 FIFA World Cup, as you know, we've published the allocations previously, and we are planning to issue with the MTBPS just an update on spending, the kind of spending that's happened. So we've, in our database, included a specific section where, at the sub-program level, where those who are, have 2010 commitments or allocations have to reflect it in particular. And the idea, as I said, is to give you a summary on progress against the 2010 World Cup. Some departments have also given guarantees to FIFA, and we want to reflect those as well so we can have a very good picture of what our liabilities and commitments are. I won't dwell on the performance information framework because it will be discussed in detail. Suffice it to say, it will apply to you know, national, provincial, and local government and their entities. And then we've got conditional grants, which the pretty Mr. Halali isn't here, but maybe it's a good thing. That's his particular I'm hoping you'll be easy. So just to then give you some highlights. We've limited the number of bids per department because we want them to examine their baseline. We want them to look at what they have, how they're spending it, whether they're allocating it efficiently, and we're saying, if you've done all that and stripped out your non-recurrent expenditure and looked at your strategic plan, we want you to only think about four new things that you need extra money for. Because what happens is we get bids that are much larger than the resources, the funding envelope available. The 35 Rand I was showing you. We get bids for, you know, in the just to give you a relative sense, of 500 Rand for only 35 Rand available because everybody is chasing after new money. And we've tried lots of ways to get departments to think about it, and now we've just given them a limited sense. Four new things, you have to think really hard about the priorities, and we will examine the ones that are relevant. It should be costed. We want to know what legislative implications, administrative implications there are, and how you will implement it. And this year as well, we want to know how the money is going to be spent. If we decide to fund a particular program, if the argument is persuasive, what value will we get for the money that we're going to allocate? So we need output and outcome up front with your budget submission.
Yes, sir. My question was quite...
I think we see questions everything. Let's just say...
Clarity, okay.
Yeah. Questions and clarity everything.
Alright.
Okay. And sometimes, you know, for due to external factors, exchange controls, delays, etc., in capital projects, there might be a deviation from the business plan that was submitted, you know, last year, for example, we asked that those be disclosed, and then some budget analysts, because of the relationship they have with the department and because they know their outstanding issues, will ask for extra information pertinent to a particular department. Now, you will notice that the MTEF guidelines are 29 pages long, and it includes a chapter, provincial chapter, which is quite substantial. The challenge we've got from our DDG is to minimize the amount of instruction. So the details, what we tell them and how we want the budget submission to be prepared, should be as easy and plain and simple to understand as possible. Our challenge, therefore, is to reduce the content every year, but still make sure that it's relevant and that we get quality information. Just on the conditional grant process, we've realized that there's some disconnect, de-linking between budget submissions and conditional grants. Often, the funding for a conditional grant is sort of added on at the last minute. We first think about the policy of priority, and then when we think about how we're going to fund it, we come up with a conditional grant, because that way we can ensure that the program, that we can monitor the outputs and performance of the grant. So for this year, the innovation we've introduced is that the conditional grant process will form part of NTEC, because we think it will provide a more rigorous approach to planning. It will align the plan, strategic plan, budget, and capacity of the individual and organization. I'm sure in your discussions and debates with municipalities and provinces, they complain about the conditions of these grants, you know, that they can't comply with them, it's difficult to spend the funding, etc. And if we have a sense of what the conditions are, during our interview, then we're better able to engage on the conditionalities and streamline the processes. We also think that it will improve communication within and outside National Division, and I think just facilitate easier implementation of the Division of Revenue Act. There'll be more accountability in terms of the four E's. Well, we've added the fourth one, equity, but economy, efficiency, effectiveness, which enables us to determine value for money, and as I said, it should be aligned to the framework for managing program performance information. So we will align the conditional grant cycle with the budget cycle. We're going to identify non-financial information, and we've issued a separate template where we want to have these questions that I told up front answered. And we're going to establish a grants committee as part of MTEC to look at the grant framework in relation to a department's strategic plans and programs. And we're focusing, emphasizing the department's capacity to monitor implementation of conditional grants.
Can I make a proposal, please?
A proposal? Okay. Just a short one. Thank you, Curtin. I wanted to suggest that as we're just coming up to infrastructure budgeting guidelines, it may be quite useful if we cleared up any misunderstandings of the basic budget process, and wanted to request that there would be an opportunity for 3 minutes of questions and comments.
Sorry, Chair, what I would, I think that's a good proposal, Ms. Pump. What I would suggest, though, is there are two more slides on infrastructure, because I'm not going into that in detail. That would cover the basic structure of the budget process, and I would have paused there before Robert continues, if that fits with your program.
Yes, So the infrastructure budgeting guidelines are intended to ensure a more rigorous approach to capital bids and will be appraised by a capital budget committee. As I said, they were due on the 27th of July, and we require a project concept note. I mean, they have quite detailed scrutiny of capital projects, you know, and requirements, which I won't necessarily discuss today. But just for your information, there are three broad categories of capital projects or programs. They're what we call mega projects, and those are more than 300 million rand per year. Large projects are between 50 and 300 million within the MTEF,
and small projects are less than 50 million per year. And we also distinguish between new projects or programs and existing projects or programs, and they will look at the feasibility and implementation challenges related to those. So with your permission, Chair, I'll pause here and we can take a round of questions before we launch into the framework for managing performance information. And any remaining questions we could also address at the end if there's any.
Okay, thanks very much. Let me just remind you that although Mr. Halani has gone outside, Mr. Akali is here and he has a Honorable
Thank you very much, Chairperson. To me, what would be important is a very clear understanding of the baseline. There were some references made at different points in the presentation about we really want departments to review this baseline, look at it again, and that's why we're restricting the bids to 4 and so on. And at other points, there were comments about strip out the recurrent expenditure, strip out this. Can you tell us what informs the baseline? What are the elements of the baseline? So when you're talking about the stripping out, we can get an idea. Related to that, if I may, Chairperson, would be the issue of, in terms of the review of the baseline about the finite project, you would then, of course, you would review and put forward a new baseline, as it were, on the basis of something else. But is there that rare opportunity when you have the baseline and you have the inversion of the bid, instead of saying to the department, put forward your bid, because the bid sounds like a bid for more money, the inverse would be to in fact, to put forward a percentage of a reduction to the baseline. Thank you, Chief.
Yes, thanks. Your mic?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. I'll take the next one, Honorable Dictive.
Yeah, Chief, is in
the... That's good. Alright. You may continue.
Thank you very much. Just with regard to the official development assistance, that indeed is my understanding as explained. But at some point there was talk of funds that were in the RDP fund, and because these funds were made available to us by the European Union for some or other program, and strict conditionalities that could not be satisfied, these funds had to be returned. Now, that's exactly my question, whether the very funds in the RTP funds are the same funds referred to in terms of the ODA. That basically is my question. And the next question is, seeing that there are some funds, departments, for instance, if an X number of vacancies haven't been filled, or some other expenditure which should have been incurred has not been incurred, and they will refer to that as a saving. On slide 2, on page 2 of the document, medium-term expenditure committee, have you satisfied yourself that your understanding of the saving is the same as that of department?
Mine is on page 3, all the budget process, on the cluster approach. I would like to know if the National Treasury has observed that in fact today the departments are complaining that they did do their thing. And when the money gets to the provinces, they find the problem because it's not only spent to their project. So when the money gets to the province just spends as they feel. so the money is not being sent. Not as better, the department are complaining about that.
Is there any other question? I hope it's a good thought. Yeah, on door. The question might be that you are coming on door. It's your, the question is about honorable member. Mm-hmm.
I really don't understand your relationship. I thought that we all part of one meeting. But the issue of your not current expenditure or your current expenditure, like your staffing and so on. Just with regard to staffing, we normally see a budget for personnel. And one and part of that budget, I'm informed, that is for the fulfilling up the vacancies. How do we arrive at saying there should be a certain type of budget for filling up the vacancies, I mean amount of vacancies and other vacancies are not budgeted for? What informs that decision? But the other one is on the bid. I think that the president mentioned it correctly, that the departments and municipalities, especially provincial departments, the issue of the conditionalities of this grant, I think that it has become an issue, and well, salary is good, and salary is aware of that. But what is being done to alleviate that so that, I think that salary is aware that capacity is not there to deal with it. That's why there is this complaint. But what is it that is being done, at least to ensure that it is not made difficult for them to do this budget? Because sometimes they decide not to spend because they don't want to go to the conditionalities. But obviously the funds are required there to be spent. Among the contingency reserves, are they sometimes withdrawn? If so, why are they, what do you call it, withdrawn? What is the basis of that? Thank you, Shepherd.
Yes,
thanks,
Honorable Member, Honorable Chikunga. With regard to the setting of departments, and I just want to know as to at what stage does the National Treasury decide not to allocate money to a department if it was not utilized the previous year and probably the following year. So on the case in point, for instance, might be the correctional services with the building of prison. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Member. I think you picked it up, you know, from many members. The mystery in conditionality, because the fact that we indicate that they participate in discussions of those conditions so that they would understand and know and to agree with them on what the conditions are. But at the same time, when they do not speak, they indicate that the conditionalities are stringent. Can you clarify that, Mr. Minister? Just hold on, Honorable Mashiko wants to ask a question.
It comes to this issue of conditional grants, because we are aware that some funds are being dispense without business plan. And you always say business plan must come first. Can that issue also be clarified?
Thank you, Honourable Member. You may respond, Mr. Treasurer.
Thank you, Chairperson. These were all very challenging and interesting questions. I'll do my best to respond to them, and if there's anything I've left out, please remind me so I can come back. Thank you. Ms. Fox, on the baseline examination, what we basically mean is, if you look at a department, and you look at the way their programs have been structured and the funds are allocated, some of the activities are ongoing. So, for example, if I use the National Treasury, I work in the budget office for expenditure planning, and we are responsible for producing the E&E, the big document. This will be an ongoing activity, whatever resources we require, be it personnel, printing, editors, you know, distribution, etc. For example, I mean, there are other more technical programs. The allocation here needs to reflect that under Program 2 for expenditure planning, we need to have an item that says we're going to produce the E&E, the budget, etc. And those items will have to continue with an inflationary adjustment. So in the baseline of, you know, say for instance, this subcomponent called expenditure planning, this item needs to be budgeted for because it's relevant and it's necessary for us to do it. It's almost a legal or statutory requirement, and we need to allocate resources for it. But some of the issues, for example, the G20 meeting that the National Treasury is hosting this year is once-off. It's only applicable for this year. We need to allocate resources for it. So that is an example of non-recurrent expenditure. We have to budget for it in 2007-8, but there should not be any item reflected against G20 in the future unless we have obligations following from our hosting the G20 this year. So those, when you examine your baseline, you need to look at ongoing activities that are part of your strategy that you need to do into the future unless there's a decision to terminate a particular activity or program, or to, you know, in the example of public, the Department of Public Works, for example, to expand or to, you know, escalate a particular priority. And that needs to be reviewed, and we add an inflationary adjustment because we have to assume that the cost of delivering this particular service will increase as a result of inflation going forward. So in that particular example, you cannot then say, well, we're going to cut back expenditure because this is something that you're required to do in an ongoing way. You might have to scale up on that particular activity. But to the extent that it's something that you're doing once off, you must remove that in determining your baseline. And that could include personnel, as I said, and, you know, office utilities, office renting of premises, etc. If you buy a building, for example, that would also be a once-off expenditure. It cannot be ongoing in nature. So we look at things that will continue into the future. That is considered the baseline, and we add a percentage for inflationary expectations to it. Any new priority that comes on, any, you know, in terms of our strategic plan, will then have to be added on, and you need to then make a submission for that particular activity. If it's going to be ongoing, you need to think about maintenance costs or refurbishment, etc. And if it's a one-off in nature like the G20, then there shouldn't be any maintenance or other costs in future. Your question about the percentage reduction in the baseline, that is ideally what we would want to see. We would like to see people saying, you know what, I've looked at my personnel vacancies, my staff establishment is not realistic. I've got all these positions on the establishment, but for the past 7 or 8 or 10 years, I haven't managed to fill them, so let's re-examine it, and these positions are perhaps not necessary to run the organization. But it's a way of sort of securing funding, if you like. If I have it on the establishment, then we think we can continue to budget for it and you know, perhaps use that money and buy it or shift it somewhere else to something that's not a priority. So our scrutiny as a national treasury is trying to highlight all these issues, discrepancies, you know, where people hide money or numbers, etc., so that we can determine what is realistic. Because we've done some analysis and studies, and we've looked at the grossing baseline. If it goes, you know, into 12-13% over the past 6 or 7 years, and we keep on inflating and inflating that number, it just grows bigger and bigger, and, you know, the underspending, I think, speaks for itself. So I hope I've responded to your question. In terms of the ODA RDP fund, are they the same? ODA, as I said, is donor funding, and all donor funding is, you know, deposited in the RDP account is what we call it, and dispensed from there. So if that's the linkage you're referring to, then yes, you're correct. Vacancies filled, I think I've just addressed that in my previous response. And the question of savings, I think there was a question addressed at a previous occasion on the definition of saving versus underspending. It is something that we're looking at. I believe there was in the annual report guidelines, we tried to distinguish between the two, and perhaps I didn't think about it. I should share those definitions with you. We could perhaps have some dialogue and discussions and see whether we need to issue a succinct definition of savings and distinguish that from underspending. And that, I think, would be very helpful for departments and for our own understanding. The cluster approach and, you know, the fact that provinces don't spend the money as it was intended. You know, Mustafa Lani said he will answer that question. But as you will know, provinces get the majority of their money through an unconditional equitable share. Now, we do calculations and determinations on each of the sector priorities, and that will inform the calculation of the equitable share. You will know the components that I need in order for that. Unfortunately, the equitable share is unconditional. So we cannot then go back and say, well, you know, let's impose the following conditions. If we want to make sure that money is spent on a particular priority or in a particular sector, then it has to be through a conditional grant, and there are some provincial conditional grants which you're familiar with. The other side, the flip side of the coin is the conditions that we've just heard often prevent spending because they're strenuous, they're onerous, and they make it difficult to disperse the funding. And whenever we think of funding a program, we're always challenged with this, you know, the trade of between unconditional funding, which you could just allocate and hope that people will spend it in the way that it's intended to, or conditional funding, which has its own challenges and you know, results in underspending and withholding of grant funding. But I think when we discuss the issue of the performance information framework and the kind of targets that we set and hold people accountable to, that might offer some solutions. So if you have certain targets to be met in terms of education, of rollout of health programs, and so on, the targets might ensure that the money is ultimately spent on, you know, the kind of priorities that one hopes to. But I do acknowledge the problem. I think on the conditionalities, I absolutely agree with you. Sometimes the conditions are too simple. They're difficult to implement. We don't think about those conditionalities during the design phase. And this is partly why we brought in this reform, where the conditionalities are discussed upfront as part of EdTech, because then we can consider and apply our minds much more than, you know, when the grant frameworks are published in January or in February with the budget. So the idea is to give it some thought and to think about what types of conditions would be appropriate, achieve the objectives that were intended initially, and ensure that the money is allocated and does flow and doesn't require too much of an administrative interference or burden the campus spending on the grant. The contingency grant is used really for, you know, what do you call it, unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. In general, that would be the criteria. So for the recent basic disasters, the floods and the fires, etc., India, if there were some requests for additional funding which were not budgeted for, that would be drawn down from the contingency reserve. So that's the general criteria for allocating these funds. When do we not allocate money? I think what I've tried to explain to you is our request for information in the budget submissions and the criteria that we're trying to establish upfront, you know, for budget submissions, stripping out non-recurrent expenditure, examining the baseline, and then our assessment of those budget bids should in future enable us to determine when it's appropriate or not. What happens is that the department would submit their budget bid to a budget analyst at the National Treasury. They would do an assessment of the budget bid, look at past performance, look at their capacity to implement, and make a recommendation upfront to the entry committee. Now then, these kind of issues or concerns would be raised and entered by the committee, and hopefully, you know, through that engagement, which is, you know, just for a day and a few hours, there's so many, you know, priorities to examine. Through that process, we try and make trade-offs and determine which bids to fund and which not. Many, many requests are turned down. If you ever examined departments or interrogated them, you'll hear the stories that, you know, we say no with a smile. We say to the National Treasury as well when the DG comes and asks for money for particular projects and priorities. So we do say no, but, you know, sometimes people are smart, and I think it's therefore the role of this committee and Parliament's oversight is so important to scrutinize and interrogate those allocations and the implementation of budgets. Yeah, conditional grants dispense with our business plan. That is exactly why we've brought in, you know, that particular requirement. We're saying that this is a condition. There must be a business plan, and you have to identify the targets, the outputs that are going to be achieved over the NPF upfront, and there must be monitoring capacity within the department to ensure that those conditions are being met. And I think the rest, again, is part of the oversight role. So the oversight role of Parliament. Yes, I think we should say this. You know, in our...
can I just say, follow up on the contingency of the case? Because we had a problem in... I thought it doesn't happen that way, but maybe you can explain it to us that when we dealt with this, the previous quarter report, the first quarter report, public enterprises indicated that they have a 3 billion allocation in the contingency reserve, and we couldn't understand it as a community that we thought that reserve is meant for unforeseen circumstances, and, you know, the thing that is just explained. But in their response, they indicate that National Treasury has put aside 3 billion in the contingency reserve for their spending to allocate to its entities. And we couldn't understand that. Can you clarify it?
Sorry, Chairperson, on that particular issue, I'm vaguely familiar with the conditions. I think there were some conditions, and I speak under correction, perhaps I should, you know, just consult with my colleagues in public finance, the public enterprises section, on some of the conditions that were not met up front when the allocation should have been made. And I think this was exceptional. That's not the way allocations would normally be made. It would be made through the budget process in a transparent way so that Parliament can vote on the allocation. But if memory serves, I think there were negotiations with DPE on some conditions that I had to meet up front before the allocations would be made. So there was an agreement, I believe, between the two ministers that the money would be set aside in the contingency reserve and would be allocated through the adjustment budget or the next budget once the conditions are in place. So they've made a good case, and you know, we decided to fund the initiative, but they didn't do all the homework up front, and we thought there would be some risk in dispersing the money, and therefore we sort of signaled it, but it's not guaranteed until it's being allocated or appropriated by Parliament. But if you want further details, perhaps I can consult with colleagues and give you a satisfactory answer on the terms and conditions at the latest.
We need further details because we're not satisfied as a committee in their response. You want to make four of you. Let me start with Honorable Machiko, then you will follow.
When I refer to money being accessed without business plan, it's like in health where they have some millions which they allege you have received without a business plan. Just like I asked, how is it possible for a department to get funding, conditional funding without a business plan?
Is that the National Department of Health, or are you talking about provincial? That sounds very unlikely, especially for the Department of Health. But perhaps I can get the details from you during the break, and I promise to get back to you on that particular issue.
Although possibility may be a provision given from the National Department.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I could just be clarified here, the contingency reserve, I take it that already formed part of the top line of the budget, am I right?
Yeah.
Okay, just so that I understand. The contingency reserves themselves are not synonymous with the top line of the budget. In other words, there will be but a percentage of what you would have as the top line, so that under normal circumstances, services will continue to be rendered, even as you know the MPE process is going on. And if my understanding is exactly that, what percentage of the top line would so that in the event of a disaster, for instance, you then say, okay, this is how much we put aside for that. If you could clarify me on that one. But the other question is, there might very well be certain criteria that, say, the budget analyst in National Treasury uses to determine whether a particular bid by a department is reasonable or not. But what if that particular budget analyst is acting in an unreasonable way, thereby, say, making government guilty of pursuing what some people might call contractional fiscal policy, that sort of thing, because it may not necessarily be in the public domain, that is, decisions that are made by a bureaucrat, for instance, in the National Treasury, regarding a matter like that.
Thank you, Honorable
Nimbo.
Honorable,
yes, Chairperson, my last question of this kind is one on the page 7, with reference to the broad categories of capital projects. Reference there is referred to just more than 300 million for the mega. Now, there was some suggestion in the papers the other day about transport investments of 10 billion or more not being able to go through the MTEF processes. First of all, is this the case? And secondly, the second suggestion that only this would only be accommodated in a triple P type of whatever. And if so, the final question, why?
Thanks, Honourable Member. On the same page, can you clarify the large and small project? Because the small project, to say that it's less than 6 million, which means they may be, they may come at 50 million in 2 years, it will be 100, or 90 million, just like the continue.
I have it nearly in front of me on the contingency reserve question, and when I look from 2003 onwards, we never had a contingency reserve. So there was 000, and then this year, 2007 or 2008, we have a 3 billion contingency reserve, then 8 billion to 8.9 and 19 billion. And it is not really a percentage of the budget. I think it depends on, you know, our allocations and, you know, the assumptions that we're making in terms of the economy. What funds are available, how much we'll be able to collect. So it's not really a top slice, as you said. We're just making assumptions, and I think, as the chairperson correctly pointed out, there might be some money that's sort of committed subject to conditions being met, and then it will be allocated and appropriated through an adjustment budget. But you will notice in the past we didn't even budget for a contingency reserve. The issue of unreasonable actions by bureaucrats, I think it's not impossible, but it's unlikely. I showed you up front the stringent processes that the budget first goes through. They're first assessed by budget analysts in public finance. There are teams, you know, headed up by a chief director who would review these recommendations. They then have to go to a committee of NTEC, which doesn't only compose of national treasury officials. I mentioned to you some of the external officials, you know, the head of the DDG in the presidency would, for example, sit on the committee, and from DPLG. And depending on the issue at hand, we would call in other role players to help us evaluate those, but which gives us a little bit of independence and, you know, external scrutiny. And then finally, it's presented to MINCOMBI, where most of the senior cabinet members are present. So a particular minister, although they're required to take off their traditional hat as Minister of Education or Minister of Health or Minister in the Presidency and so on, that they try and come to a collective decision collegially, the idea is that there would be some robust debate and trade-off before the final decision is made that's approved by Cabinet. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for oversight within this allocation process. As far as the transport burden and the amount, we've given these broad criteria, you know, anything above 300 is going to be a mega project. And then what I didn't present to you here is that there are various options. So we also look at how is the department going to implement this. Will they do it, you know, through their own resources? Will they appoint an external contractor? Or a PPP option as well, where you, you know, minimize the risk of government, you bring in capital, external capital, or, you know, there's a whole range of options that this is why that the Capital Budget Committee would investigate. So they might go to a particular department, look at their submission and say, you know what, we think the risks here are too high for you to carry. You won't be able to implement it. We suggest that you get someone from the private sector to bring in skills, expertise, and funding, and that government will then co-fund this particular initiative. So all kinds of options are being considered in the capital, in the capital of the city.
And then on the large versus small question, Ms. Marvin, I think you're right. The amounts were, I'm not sure if it's too scientific. I think it was based on past bids and the quantum that we've received in the past. And we sort of made a cut up and said, in general, the smaller projects are less than 50. And anything above that would be, you know, between 50 and 300 million over the MTES. So if it's 50, greater than 50 million over 3 years, it's also a large project. If it's 50 million 1 year, less than 50 million 1 year, then we consider it small. We can, you know, it can be managed by a department. If it's greater than 50 and 300 million for 3 years, then we have different criteria. We tend to look at it in much greater detail. We ask far more questions about risks, and we do cost-benefit analysis, net present value, etc., and look at the funding risks and what kind of maintenance is required in the medium to long term. And for the mega projects, of course, we go into a lot of detail and scrutiny on implementation and look at the kind of options that Ms. Fast raised as well.
Although it's technical on this one this morning, I'm still not here, but we'll take it on one-to-one basis. But it's also interesting that we can say no to Ms. Alcindor.
The directive
is interesting that your boss, you can say no to your boss. I know that with the accountant general, he came. That office came, but I didn't think that same with you that you can say no to your boss.
Okay,
we'll
continue the next
issue. Because otherwise, their job will be online. You may continue the next presentation.
Thank you very much, members. And we thought we'd take this opportunity to share with you in a little bit greater detail one of the aspects that we're emphasizing in the MTES guidelines for your information, and share with you some of the initiatives going forward and some of the reforms, so that you can be aware that hopefully the results and the fruits of this labor will be beneficial to Parliament and to your overtime role, and just to again inform you of some of the in some respects in innovations that we're implementing this year. I'd also like to clear the record that I'm not actually a consultant. Once you get a label in the government, you have to avoid that. I'm actually a secondee from the United States Treasury on a technical assistance mission here in the National Treasury. And why I don't have an American accent can be discussed at a later stage. I'm proud to be back home, that's all I can say. So, this is the sort of source document that has spurred us to start integrating and enhancing some of the performance information requirements that were already present and required to some degree in previous MTEs, in previous budget submissions. If you look at the E&E, there are non-financial tables of information for each sub-program or most sub-programs from previous years, where we've asked departments to try to put forward outputs that they can quantify, that they can target for delivery at program level. Those have been mostly qualitative in nature, although if you look at the departments like the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, those outputs are very quantitative and in general are trendable sort of indicators. But for a lot of departments, especially national departments that are mostly policy oriented,
it's harder for them to quantify their output. How do you quantify the quality of a policy that's developed and put forward to Parliament for discussion? So it gets more challenging at the national level, which is really what we're focusing on at the moment. Because in a way public finance, the division in Treasury that oversees mostly national national department expenditure, is playing catch up with our counterpart in intergovernmental relations part of Treasury, and has made significant strides in requiring provinces and departments within provinces to report outputs on a comparable basis across the departments within provinces. Let me talk a little bit about what's contained in the framework. This document has now been published and has been distributed. We're trying to locate Parliament's copies because every entity, every institution throughout the country and all three spheres of government have received the hard copies of these. It's also, of course, on our website. This is a guidance document. It tries to provide some semblance of standardization and minimum levels of regulation, not really regulation, but conformance out there related to performance indicator measurement and management, because of course this is not something that Treasury is coming forth in a vacuum. Many levels of government, many institutions have already got robust performance indicator systems in place to help them manage their operation. But the myriad of systems and the way that they've developed over the years was certainly creating some confusion out there because of the disparate ways in which things have developed. And so this doesn't provide requirements or regulation, but provides guidance to departments on what National Treasury, as a central government department, in conjunction with other initiatives, would sort of expect when we are examining performance of departments. If you could go to the next slide, Leslie. This is tightly integrated, the framework, with the government-wide monitoring and evaluation system that's depicted on the second slide. We work very closely with other central government departments like DPLG, DPSA, the Presidency, and the Auditor General's Office in developing the framework. And it fits in as an important key component of the government-wide monitoring evaluation system relating to program performance. In fact, we were just at the Presidency yesterday for a meeting to talk about progress made and in fact share some of the same presentation with them. Again, with an update, they're quite familiar with the document. And in fact, there'll be a monitoring and evaluation task team that the Presidency is heading up that will be meeting at the Union Buildings next week to bring together not just National Treasury but all the other departments that have a key role in this area. Evaluations are something that the Presidency will be taking forward in developing frameworks. Each of these boxes are going to have frameworks attached to them that describe what it is in nature, each of these areas. Census and survey information, mostly the purview of SAS SA, who have already developed a draft document that tries to provide standardization, standard levels of quality around administrative information that's produced by departments. We know Department of Housing, Department of Health, various departments produce statistics, put out on their website about services delivered, but there isn't a lot of validation that goes behind what departments are saying they're doing compared to what they are actually doing. The Auditor General does not audit at this stage performance information, although that is a key reform coming up. But SAS-SA is going to be involved. If a department produces a statistic related to their output, they're going to be required to follow certain norms and standards related to the development of that statistic in relation to or in conformance with national statistic standards, SAS-SA standards. Briefly, the performance information on the next slide, the framework, again, was an outgrowth of this realization that there were a myriad of systems being developed. There's a lot of confusion out there. And it's not, you know, individual departments and entities are not are free to pursue their own system. But when you start trying to compare an output or an outcome or a result of some sort across departments, whether you're the presidency or you're the national treasury, then you run into difficulty very quickly because everybody's got their own idea about what an outcome or a result is. Some people view that as simply an output, a service that's delivered, the number of clients served in a certain period or provided a certain service, like number of parcels. Departments, some departments would view that as the result of their work. And as part of the framework of defining those kinds of results or as the outputs of the results of the activities that we put in place, but they're not really the long-term impact on society. The importance of producing a passport has significant societal importance and living in a democracy, and those working to identifying the achievements in those areas and targeting that is seen and viewed by us at the National Treasury and defined in the framework as the kinds of long-term goals that are the results of the work that we do. And so in addition to that, we've got, we felt like there was a need to standardize, to provide some level of standardization around performance information because of the importance increasing importance of measuring value for money. National Treasury has gotten better over the years at tracking expenditure by program and by economic classification. Departments have gotten better over the years at spending their allocations more efficiently. But there is a question now, now that we have time to focus on this question, the more value-added question of what are we getting for the allocations? What is the true value that are the result of the amounts that are allocated, and trying to measure this across the four E's that are defined within the framework: economy, effectiveness, efficiency, and equity. Also to help identify underperformance and service delivery, not just really identify that underperformance, because that's sometimes quite obvious, but if a robust system of performance indicators is used to track success and to monitor delivery at a lower level than just the results of our work, we might be able to use a system like this to actually identify the causes of the underperformance and target better and more discrete solutions. Improving the linkage between strategic planning and budgeting. This is key. We know that often these statutory documents are produced in isolation from each other. Strategic plans are produced quite often by strategic planning units in consultation with consultants. The budget often by the finance unit and the CFO, not involving at times the strategic planning unit. And then the annual reports by the communications unit, the marketing consultant. And so sometimes linking the planning to the budgeting to the results that are reported in the end of the day is obviously critical, and a thread of performance indicators that are identified upfront in the strategic plan is considered for achievement in budget allocation and then reported against not just the spending but also in this way the non-financial performance is seen as an innovation that can tie together these important the planning process in general and the reporting process. Developing standards, we talked about improving accountability, of course, to legislators and oversight entities. We're trying to get to the point of reporting the results of the expenditures, the results of the activities, and not just the fact that we spent our money. What did you spend it on, and what did we achieve? And the ability to be able to reward good performance. In terms of the purpose of the framework and the guidance that's provided, the key areas of guidance include the idea that performance information, performance systems are not separate, or shouldn't be developed separately from existing management systems, and should be integrated tightly with financial systems. There are M&E units that are present in many institutions and government entities, and sometimes we found that while we have an M&E unit now that's supposed to develop systems and mechanisms to report and track information and performance, often they're doing that in isolation from the line manager, from the CFO, from the senior management. They're sort of given that task and seen as the owners of that task. Collecting information is important, and you need a capacity to do that once you target the performance information to be reported, but it's always going to be the usefulness of performance information to various levels within the department, including at the basic level of the line manager, shouldn't be underestimated, and it's emphasized in the framework. We also talk about roles and responsibilities. We do not define them. We just identify the typical roles and responsibilities of different role players in relation to performance information. Talk about promoting accountability and transparency to Parliament and reporting of performance information, publishing it, not just for internal usage for management, but for the consumption of oversight entities, but also for citizenry, for stakeholders, for constituents. Be able to provide it in a published form that is understandable to the general public, not just for use by bureaucrats and politicians, although that is also important. Standardizing terminology. And on the next slide, we show in the framework we have a pyramid that's probably one of the most important diagrams, I suppose, in the document, where we are identifying the five levels of performance or categories of performance indicators from the input level up to impact, and talk about the importance of identifying performance information at these different levels and adopting a results-based management approach whereby we sort of plan for the outputs and the outcomes and target and organize ourselves. Develop a strategic plan, not in relation to what we do, but in what we should be achieving. And that's when we sort of depart from the guidance that's provided in the framework and actually decided that there are parts of this that, because it's a guidance document that National Treasury needs to adopt for itself, take forward and operationalize in some form. And so that's when decided that it was important to look at the performance information requirements that we had in previous NCEF guidelines, and we're going to enhance that. Before I go on with that, I meant to reference one of the other documents that we provided for you in the packet. This is a document produced by the Office of the Presidency. Development Indicators for Midterm Reviews was published just recently, about 2 months ago. We would view as the sort of impact level of indicators that's shown at the top of that pyramid. In most cases, that's what they are. They talk at a societal level of the results of the work of government, whether it's poverty alleviation or economic growth or safety and security. And this kind of report is seen as something that departments might want to look at and be able to develop down the road for themselves. A mini version of this for each department could be developed to produce a picture of the work that they do and the results that they achieve on a vote level, and then down at the province, at the individual province, provincial departments. Quickly within the MCEF framework, what we decided to do was focus primarily on the output and outcome level, the sort of middle level within that pyramid of indicators. We already were asking departments to report outputs at the sub-program level. We wanted this year to sort of step up the game a little bit and ask departments to start thinking more than output, more than counting what you do, although that's important. Start thinking at a programmatic level about the results of what we do. And we're linking them to programs and sub-programs because that's also the basis the method that we use to allocate funds. We try to bring the performance, the non-financial information, closer and more comparable to the funds and the basis on which funds are allocated, so that we can compare, hopefully, the funds and the allocation to the results. And so we also sort of, as shown on this chart, have focused on 5 departments on which to pilot another level of innovation that we're testing very carefully with 5 individual departments and trying to assess the our ability to be able to roll this out to other departments, the other 29 votes in the coming year. So that's what we call trendable and quantitative performance information, and I'll talk a little bit about each of these. On the next slide, I show the table that was actually provided in the NTEF guidelines and in the NTEF database, whereby departments are asked to identify on this, in this format, an outcome and a target. Now, for the performance information required of all departments, we didn't put a lot of requirements in place around the phrasing, the way that a performance indicator is actually defined and developed and described. That's still left quite open, and it's going to be qualitative in nature. We're, like I said, we're testing something more quantitative in nature with 5 departments, but for the time being, we did step it up a little bit, but there's still lots of opportunity for improvement in this area. The next slide shows an example of the kinds of outputs we're expecting to see. We've already received the submissions from departments. They were due August 10th with the allocation and the budget bid. Included with that was the performance information at the program and sub-program level. We've looked at the results, such as the submission. Each budget analyst is going through the non-financial information. I won't say at the same level as the financial information at this point. We targeted, most of this information will be produced at the point at which the E&E is published, and will be contained there. And so at a later stage, towards that deadline, which is around December, for departments to submit their E&E submissions, we're going to be getting a lot more scrutinizing about the types of indicators that were suggested and put forward, whether they are truly output in nature, and whether the targets are reasonable or not. That's an analysis that's underway, and we'll get much more attention once we've gotten past the financial decision-making processes which are currently in place around MTEC. The sub-program level, we asked departments to also look back at the previous year because we had outputs that were identified in the E&E. So we asked them to report the progress based on one quarter's time passed in the 07-08 fiscal year. Progress against the targets that were stated in the E&E. We're not expecting a lot of progress to have been achieved. Really, the goal was to start to make departments think about that target that they stated in the E&E, to think about the fact that Treasury is taking this seriously, that we want to know what the results are. We don't like to expect that there's going to be a lot of results based on only one quarter's time frame passed, but again, it's more of a signal to the department to start thinking about these performance targets that they've identified in the past as being important, as being valued, that's being scrutinized by stakeholders and oversight entities. For the trendable perform, to skip ahead to the next slide, for the 5 pilot departments, which are the South African Police Services, the Department of Public Works, the Department of Public Service Administration, Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, and the Department of Corrections. Those are the 5 pilot departments that we're testing this out with. We're going to try and get much more quantitative and trendable in nature. The table that's shown on the slide there, you will notice, is very much in conformance with the table that is used to present financial information in the budget in the E&E. Looking back 3 years of past performance, looking at the current year, an estimate, and looking forward 3 years. this again starts allowing us to compare performance over a period of time and to be able to compare performance against budgets that are allocated in the same format, in the same table structure, that we'll be able to, in the E&E, bring these two key pieces of information closer together, just so a person is able to eyeball on a single page, hopefully, the allocation path and future, and the performance path and future. Sometimes formatting and how something is going to be presented on paper is important to consider, and we did try to take that into account. The next slide just shows a fictional Department of Agriculture. This is not our Department of Agriculture, but shows the current an example of the kind of output we're hoping to be able to see from departments. We're working very closely with them. We didn't just submit increased requirements to departments and are waiting for the responses. We're speaking to them on a regular basis. We're workshopping with them the process that they're putting in place to develop these indicators. We have our technical assistance unit, who I know you met with when you were up in Pretoria, helping departments to think about results-based management approaches, to think about how these indicators relate to their strategic planning processes. And so it's not just tell us your indicators in a vacuum. That's not really something that's feasible if you're not a results-oriented or data-oriented organization. It takes a lot more effort to get the ball rolling on an initiative like this, and that's why we're piloting it. That's why we're working closely with those departments. As we learn, they are learning as well. And there is a learning curve for both National Treasury and the department. The last slide, almost the last slide, just identifies a detailed definition, a definitional structure that we're providing or asking departments to provide for each indicator identified. This kind of detailed explanation of what we're measuring, why we're measuring it, is not a requirement for the other departments, for the other performance information, and it's one of the areas that we're using to step up usage of performance information. Finally, I wanted to brief you on an initiative that we've mentioned to you before that you are aware is coming. We were hoping to be able to share with you a proposed format for an in-year monitoring report that we're producing specifically for the usage of the Joint Budget Committee that will provide a lot more detail on departmental expenditures. As you know, the Section 32 provides expenditure information at the vote level, and it's produced on a monthly basis. This is going to provide a lot more detail behind that expenditure, behind the vote. Every program, every sub-program will be itemized. The spending by month will be identified. The spending by program, broken up by economic classification, will be provided. The cash flow analysis will be provided. I know that you've already received detail on each department's projections going forward, of which cash flow is obviously the prime purpose of that. Departmental receipt information, sometimes that's more useful than other times. That in general needs to be customized more. We're working on an internal in-year monitoring improvement process whereby we can improve the system internally, and that will inform and assist our external reporting abilities down the road. For example, you'll find that departmental receipt information right now will tell you at the Department of Home Affairs, give you a line item, random amount collected for services delivered, because that's the structure or the reporting structure for our departmental receipts. What would be more interesting and useful to all of us is how much did you, what were the revenues from passport issued, what were the revenues from ID books issued, what were the revenues from what you actually did. These are reforms that are in place now so that you can actually understand at a more detailed level what we're getting from departments. But in general, even though this is going to be fairly high level still in nature, at the program level, for example, sub-program level, should assist all of us to quiz departments in public about their spending trends, again, because it is more detailed, and to also identify and ask departments to talk to us about the results, the longer term outputs that they're achieving. We're hoping again to have the report actually available today or a draft format. We were not able to meet that personal deadline that we set for ourselves for you all. We will have something within the next couple of weeks. It's gone through some internal processes, and that's what's delayed
us.
But we will have something for this committee and for the staff of the committee to engage on in the next couple of weeks. So that'll be coming. On the last slide, I just wanted to show you all where you can access some of the documents that we've shared with you today on our website under guidelines. Is it under documents and then the guideline documents. So they're basically all the documents, the guidelines, the framework, performance information can be accessed electronically at that source. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks, the page that I have shared. First, you are a consultant.
Yes.
And I thought that maybe, you know, sometimes things happen quickly.
Well, it's much more accurate. I'm referring to myself, although it's not accurate. I like to clear the record.
So I thought that maybe in the past few weeks, you decided to become a consultant, and now you're a full-time consultant. So I thought it was okay, but since then, you clarified it. Honorable Swart, you are following this expectation. And we have, I think I must acknowledge the presence of a young man over there, the student, Jonathan. We are happy that you are here with us so that you can observe, he's interested in political science, so that you are watching what is that we are doing, so that you take for a young person, you don't think that we are just sitting in parliament and not doing anything. And I'd also like to acknowledge the presence of Honorable Member Dan Kotule from the Free State Provincial Legislature. Yes, he's with us, he's the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Finance. So you are welcome, Honorable Member. And let's take questions, Member. Honorable Kwa.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair. In fact, this is really it's a very, very constructive and welcome presentation. Certainly, I believe it's going to assist us in our oversight. What would assist someone, certainly perhaps like myself and perhaps a few other colleagues, we've got these indicators, we've got their definitions and so on, but if we begin to take them through, and apply the theory to, you know, the operation. So, for example, the one you've used here, which would be the Department of Agriculture, and we looked, you spoke about certain programs here, the different targets there, the indicators would be the stated target, etc. And then further on, of course, we have the need to apply the triangle of the indicator, the output, the outcome, and the impact, etc. Fine. When we come to the page 14, if we were to kind of track this through, this concept of the grain, we're in the budget, we're not in agriculture, we want to know now, they've done very well, we say that. All the numbers are here. So that means a positive target, you know, 100%. My query would be, you can achieve the numerical figure. You can achieve 10 tons and I can get 10 tons out. And you can say, that was fantastic. What you may have done to achieve the 10 tons is to destroy the farm in question, or the farm. Poor farm management. So you've achieved the target. Now, I would like to learn, co-chairs, how we actually measure that. To me, it's not simply a measure of getting that 10 tons. It's got to be a few other things. And I can hear that we're doing it, but I can't see how it's done. Or if we're going to exercise our oversight, and we get that target measured, and we tell this is the, you know, the activity or this and that, how do we put that together? Or would your proposal or suggestion be at the activity level, the indicator there, we measure that, we oversize that, at the next level, the output level. So when we get to the 10 tons, we're able to say, what? The tonnage target was achieved, but in every other respect, more harm than good was done. Words to that. Perhaps we can just get that clearer understanding.
The next question is from the Honorable Deputy Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Look, we've got development indicators and we've got the framework for managing program performance information. And I think both documents being predicated on the whole concept of government-wide monitoring and evaluation, which is, say, an umbrella vehicle, if you like, for individual units of M&E in various departments. Now, let's say, for instance, if you take the Public Service Commission, which reports on a wide range of issues, and that would include everything that to do with the government-wide monitoring and evaluation, government-wide monitoring and evaluation, does it also report independent of yourself, and who would say carries the greater than of responsibility in ensuring that ultimately what is envisaged in these documents is indeed realized? I understand that the PSC, of course, is another entity which falls within the family of Chapter 9 associated institutions, not trying to conflate their role with yours, who then would you say is responsible for ensuring that all of these things? And so I think just piggybacking on Honorable Fox's question about the tonnage and the exact things that are happening there. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Sogoni.
Well, I think that is moving in the right direction, that now departments will be required to produce this information, because I think that as committees, this is the information that we have been looking for. Not just your, as Comrade Fatma was saying, not just your figure. But you indicated that there are five departments that are pilot departments. And I'm saying, so as committees, we've been trying to get this information, but there was no guideline for it. Now, what does it mean if we're doing oversight beyond these five departments? Is there anything that stops us from doing it in other ways, both departments? Will they have information that they may also look into this, though they are not necessarily done level four in this ambit of the pilot department? Thank you, Chairman.
Okay.
The other part of my question related to what I asked. You know, at one point the DG, National Treasury, that is, that some DGs in Portland complain of reporting fatigue because of the existence of Chapter 9 institutions and a whole myriad of other avenues that, require them to report, etc. Now, if you take into account the role of the PSC, for instance,
which would have a direct interest in this process, but also the Human Rights Commission from the point of view of the report on socioeconomic rights. I would imagine that they would also have interest in that. So, good intentions notwithstanding, isn't there a danger that being required to report on this, taking into account the two institutions, there may be more that I've mentioned, what is the risk of the negative unintended consequences coming forth more than the positive ones in this process?
Through with questions. National Trader will now respond.
Thank you very much for those questions. All relevant and all important. It's one of the unintended consequences, something that we struggled with ourselves when drafting the framework. And we actually had on page 7, section 3.2, we identified six indicators six criteria for a good performance indicator. And perverse incentives, we don't have that stated, but item E became is one of the criteria is for the importance that an indicator be appropriate, thereby must avoid unintended consequences and encourage service delivery improvements and not give managers incentives to carry out acts simply to meet a particular target. And there's a lot more behind that, obviously. This is a pretty concise document. We can have, you can have details and discussion on that because the world over where performance information, something that on the surface sounds like a great idea to start emphasizing, it does have the potential, especially when you start targeting or tying performance of the organization to individual manager performance contracts, which eventually is what else is your performance contract based on? That's the performance of the organization. Obviously, you're not held entirely accountable. And that is an important linkage that CPSA is keen to make once we have verifiable, quantifiable, valid indicators in place to enhance our HR management practices in government. But it can result in these perverse incentives that managers might pursue just in order to meet the one thing that's scrutinized, because now we've left aside activities which talk to how the target was achieved and can give that kind of that information to oversight entities to say, hold on, you might have met your target, but look at the results of that. So in the framework, we raise it as an important issue. We, in working with the five pilot departments, especially where we're actually able to do that hands-on interface and engagement, that's going to be an important aspect of what kinds of indicators are identified and how they are utilized. We also realize already we're learning lessons through the piloting process where, and I think that you'll probably see in following iterations of this quantifiable, trendable indicator system that we do not ignore activity. We have this year focused on outputs and outcomes as if that's all that matters. And honourable response is absolutely correct. That's not all that matters. We're trying, for a variety of reasons, trying to target things that Treasury might be appropriately interested in. We cannot micromanage. We wouldn't want to. So to what extent do we want to know or about activities? But we realize, first of all, that for policy-oriented departments, sometimes quantifying the activities is as important as quantifying the results, because the results are so hard to quantify sometimes. And GBSA is part of the pilot for that purpose, because so much of what they do is qualitative in nature. And so we're not going to leave that aside, and it's an important issue that we will be focusing on to the best of our abilities. There's always trade-offs, including reporting fatigue or negative consequences like that. This is not a new reporting. The way I guess we view it is that we're asking departments, in a sense, to report on something that they are doing. Department of Education is doing it. DWAP is doing it. We're asking them maybe to think about it in a different way, to link their performance information to their budget allocation so that it can inform the decision-making, it can inform the oversight. So in many departments, this is already being done. And where it isn't being done, the results are sort of obvious as well. How can you manage any organization without information that's standardized, that's reliable, that comes to decision makers on a regular basis, that can be compared over time? There isn't really, in any organization, we need data to manage. And yet, if you haven't got the systems in place to collect the data of what you're doing, how you're doing it, what you're achieving, then that looks like burdensome requirement. Now, Treasury is making us do this. Well, Treasury is not really making you do it. This is something that every management practice and every textbook will tell you need to be doing. How can you be managing without data? And it's not just having the data reported on an ad hoc basis. It's about having it reported on a frequent and regular basis so that you can see your results over time. You can see the impact of initiatives. And in general, it's happening, but there are areas where it has been absent, where we have charismatic leaders that lead by example, that lead through their personalities, and can achieve great things. And people hold accountable on a personal basis. And don't need the data somehow. And there are, those are few and far between, unfortunately. I think a lot of people think they're charismatic leaders when they're not. So we're trying to move away from the charismatic leader model into more of a structured management approach that is predicated on best practices like a results-based management approach that we are able to in implementing. And in fact, we're working very closely with the Department of Corrections. I think it's going to be an exceptional pilot that we're going to learn a lot from because they're so engaged. Okay, so who is responsible for implementation? It's going to be PSC is hopefully going to be an important benefactor of this kind of information. I think that it's a good point that you raise, and we need to probably make sure that they are more engaged in the government-wide monitoring and evaluation initiative that's going forward. I know that they're aware of it, but maybe, we think DPLG from the provincial level, we think DPSO from the human resource level, we're including these role players, we think of the AG, Auditor General from the auditing, and sometimes things get left off, and I think the PSC might have been somebody that's not been tightly integrated into the system as it could have been. Leslie can correct me if I'm wrong because she's also very involved. In terms of non-pilot departments, last question that I'll address. Again, as I mentioned, Department of Education is not a pilot department, but they are tracking their results and their information. So there's nothing stopping other departments. In fact, we had departments like SAS SA, which of course is data-driven, also volunteer to be a pilot department. We had the Department of Justice volunteer to be a pilot department. So there were actually people that wanted to come forward and say, we've got the data, let's work with Treasury to bring it closer to the stages so that we can justify, it's not that the Iranians are holding, we can use, we know we've got good data, we know that if we could share this data with you on our results, you would probably give us more money, not less money. You know, that's their expectation, and the Department of Justice making headway, significant headway in reporting backlogs, tracking backlogs, having that data to be able to make decisions. So there are a lot of sources of this kind of data even with the non-pilot departments. And they're eager to share that in most occasions. Lydia, do you want to add something?
I just wanted to hold these up for you so that you can see. It's not a coincidence that they look similar. It was by design. This one came first, and because it's all part of the same kind of framework, one way to show that we're finally aware of what everybody's doing was by having, you know, similar kind of formatting layout and presentation. Now, this is a Treasury document. The size might be different, but you can conceptually see that we talk about the same issues. In finalizing this document, and it's important that members know this, we had to go through extensive and very rigorous consultation. In fact, we didn't quite meet our deadlines. There have been requests from, I think it was the, from SCOPA, you know, on this framework, when we're going to finalize it. But we had to talk to our counterparts, DPRG, OPSC, the presidency, and you know, all these kind of what we call monitoring agencies to ensure that everybody knows that reissuing the terminology in this document, that this will then inform the basis on which others would require outputs, activities. We all understand what the terminology means. So in theory, although the OPSC would monitor different aspects, it would all be done. The way it's reported would be done in terms of our framework. So this is the founding document and guidelines on performance information. And whether DPLG requests information from a municipality, or the Premier's office from a province, or the Presidency compiles it all together, this will be the document that informs the kind of standards and guidelines for reporting on performance information. But we're not overlapping on the mandate of the OPSC. We just consulted with them on drafting and finalizing our documents. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Honorable Carson, then Honorable Chairman.
Yes, Chairman, this is a very short one. Just in view of recognition of the perverse or unintended consequence indicator. Certainly, I think one could appeal to National Treasury and those directly involved with this framework to provide some sort of space within the framework that will allow the different departments and divisions within the departments, when they give the indicator and they set the target, in the same way one would use with the financial management hard numbers, talk about what are the risk indicators here, the risk management and so on, and one assesses that, there are risk criteria. So when you have this indicator, certainly you want to achieve the positive aspect and you choose the most appropriate. However, having really analyzed that, you also are able to recognize that there could be, there is a potential for it to move in this, and you list them. This is the potential risk here that's possible. And I think it would help us, co-chairs, within the budget committee, for example, having looked at that, to say, right, they've recognized that, maybe they've run one short, and we can add another one. But at least we know that they've applied their minds somewhat effectively to the indicator development.
More of a comment than a question.
Okay. Yes, just to say, we have bombarded National Treasury with
a barrage of questions, perhaps it's time to be a little more generous with our comments, and I think following on what Honorable Pastor said, well, we should commend them for great work they are doing. Perhaps it's by sheer coincidence that not long after the publishing of the World Bank report on development indicators, then we have the public, the policy coordination and advisory services in the presidency also doing that. Yeah, I'm saying that perhaps to be a little more generous. I'm not saying that the presidency or our government is aping with the World Bank, but I'm just saying perhaps it's a recognition of the fact that we are an open or integrated economy, and of course all the international forums that we participate in and so forth. And I think our own Minister of Finance is on record as saying that these forums must be transformed. Very good point. But I just want to say that I feel very pleased indeed that we are doing the kind of work with this quality. And I just went onto the website of the World Bank and for the development indicators, I think, dated April 2007, if I'm not wrong. And to see these points as well, the 10 points, for health indicators, etc., that we are using them, and linking that with the framework is indeed very pleasing. But I just want to ask one last question. I'm not so sure whether I wasn't paying attention when you probably mentioned it. I'm actually worried, and we've talked about the challenges of conditional grants, particularly the equitable share. But this framework being adapted to local governments, like we've got provincial departments of local government, etc. And I'm talking about problems that are there and very genuine. You will have a project going on and it's, say, maybe it's supposed to last only for 6 months, and it goes into its 8th or even 12th or even 14th month. Trenches have been dug, and sometimes we have terrible accidents of children falling in there. And if I may make an example, just in the process of trying to eradicate the budget system, for instance, and you'll be told this contractor ran out of money or something like that. What is it that we can do so that the actual impact is felt on the ground in a positive way, guided pretty much by the lesson spirit of the framework?
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is a very simple one. Maybe in his closing remarks, the gentleman can then tell us as to what happened to his American accent.
What was the first indicator?
It's pretty much affected by climate change, alcohol, and warning of the back.
This one may be outstanding. Could you?
Yeah. A simple request that you need to do. Let's take housing. The provision of housing. That in the annual report, they will indicate that they've allocated so many subsidies, but find, and they would count the subsidies that have been allocated as part of their report. They will include uncompleted projects. They will include projects which are a health hazard,
as part of what they deliver. Can you put, take that one as an example and indicate how is it going to be reflected and how can we monitor that one? Practically.
You can respond.
Thank you very much. I guess I never had one to lose in the first place. My South African wife kept me very honest. And I never got to talk with the twang. She wouldn't let me, so I never got to develop that, even all the years I spent over in the great state of Texas. As they call it. I think that's the official name, actually. It's him to make, the member raises a good point, a bureaucrat loves his fiddle around and make innovations, make improvements, make reforms, and how does it all matter in the end of the day? And I think it's just incumbent upon all of us to make sure that it matters, that as an oversight entity, a parliament from a legislative perspective, make sure that the information is used to hold ourselves as government accountable for the promises and the targets that we make. These are data that it's raised in the framework when we talk about the importance of publishing this information, not just using it internally for our management, improving our management practices, but reporting it externally, whether it's positive or not. And we have them again, this was a guidance document. We didn't say you must produce X document and publish it this way by a certain date every year. That would have been erroneous. But we do expect that through good practice, departments are reporting their data and their results. National Treasury is also going to look at the feasibility of producing reports on the indicators that are reported to us by department down the line. Once we are able to show this trendability or get trendable information, there's nothing stopping us from reporting on key indicators at the departmental level and having them explain to us why targets were not met and being able to communicate that to National Treasury publications. This will be all departments that won't focus or target individual departments, but publishing it and putting it out there for public consumption is just as important as collecting it and using it for our own internal management purposes. And in terms of the quality of the indicators, this is something that is a struggle. Departments are the know best, much better than Treasury, their business, and we have to rely on them to identify the indicators that they're going to use to measure their results. However, we've relied too much on them in the past. We also have our constraints, and we'll end up spending 75% or 80% of our time focusing on the financial bit and too little on the non-financial information that we've now requested. That's a challenge for us. We may need to reorient ourselves organizationally to make sure that we spend a good amount of our time focusing on the non-financial information. It's sort of a mind shift for us internally as well. Treasury would be quite happy to just focus on the budget and the expenditure. And that is our core job. But we realize that isn't enough. So that's why we're getting into the field of actually measuring what's achieved and value for money, which is also the responsibility of the party. The point, I guess, that I'm getting to is we have to step up our game and not just take what departments submit to us as their performance. We have to be able to interrogate that. We have to be smart enough about the Department of Housing to know that they're counting all sorts of strange things in houses delivered. What's the definition of a house? Is it just the base structure? Is it the roof? Subsidy isn't a house. And we've had this debate at National Treasury. We've had direct differences of opinion on that exact indicator. And that
that isn't even part of a performance information pilot or anything like that. That was a, you know, that's an important indicator, and the disagreement about what constitutes how to deliver is already surfaced. We are, like I say, going to step up our game and not just to receive the indicators and receive the data, but interrogate it, make sure that it is, you know, valid and useful and relevant, and try and use our checklist of criteria for a good indicator to encourage departments to develop more useful and more useful information, not just you know, subsidies or something like that in the case of housing. Mm.
That might be the last question from Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Sam. For the benefit of the others, we have just returned from the NCOP side, just returned from a visit to the Northern Cape. And something I would like to ask about, we've seen that there have been enormous challenges. Mm. Education is one of those, but also clinics. And the value of the clinics, where they're situated, and I thought this is something that we should actually look at in relation to housing. Where do we place our clinics so that they are accessible to people? So that we're looking at what the clinic is able to provide, whether it's got medication staff, all those sort of things, but where it is able to produce or provide a service to the people. Because sometimes these things are far removed from one another, and I think one of the problems we have of planning in silos, I think there needs to be integration.
The silence now means to work on confusing. Oh, okay. Please come on board.
No, there can't be silence. Okay. I think that the, I think on this time, you know, improve on page 6 and 7, improve activities and output. I think that the department can report on those. Do you think that it will be proper for departments to report on outcome and intent? I think that now this goes back maybe to the question that Honorable Richebe was asking about other what we call it issues now. We can really observe in terms of the outcome and the intent. I'm not sure people think to me the department will play referees and judges themselves if the, they have to report on the outcomes themselves. Because the experience, I mean, among the members here that we have, if you don't have those observations, you're sitting here in Parliament and you get a report, you'll be told very glamorous what you call a report. This is what we have done. This is how the... Now, that's why I'm raising this question. But the second one would be, you know, with the implementation of the PSMA and the MSMA, they were implemented, they were phased in over time, but there was a target that by a certain time, all the departments, or in the case of PSMA, for instance, must have concluded or by this department, must be able to report in line with the requirements of PSMA. Same with the MSMA.
One is there a target date? What?
on this one, is there a target date by which that everybody now must have conformed with the requirement? Thank you.
Some more people.
Thank you very much.
Comment on the comment.
In terms of the outcomes, well, something that relates to also your target date question, the Auditor General is coming on board in relation to this as well. They are eager to monitor and evaluate and audit performance information. They have already started monitoring or in auditing the systems and the level of alignment of performance information, systems that produce performance information, and the level of alignment between the strategic plan, the indicators that are identified in the strategic plan, and in the budget and in annual reports, making sure that they're reported in the way that they are, so that they're going to be reported, and that there's integrity in the systems that capture the information. So we have, the challenge is going to be to develop good indicators that are useful, and not only indicators that are likely to focus only on the positives. We need to, in order to, this is not a witch hunt process, but we need to have the indicators need to provide a fuller picture as possible of the of the results. And so it's a challenge to us as National Treasury, to departments themselves, to other entities that are going to be involved over time that, in identifying indicators that are useful so that we are able to develop a good set of indicators per department that talk to the entirety of their outcomes. This is not going to be a one-off process whereby indicators are set up and then not touched. Ideally, we're going to try to maintain the indicators and not change them a lot, but adding indicators where they're absent will be possible by a variety of role players. And in terms of target dates, part of it is going to be driven by the Auditor General's schedule, and there's a schedule for Executive 08-09 and through 2010, whereby they're going to increase their scrutiny and their auditing of indicators. National Treasury is, through these guidance documents and through our FTF requirements, increasing the type and the number of performance information that need to be gathered. And then that the auditor picks up from there and audits those indicators. Not to question the indicators themselves, but to audit the integrity of them, and that's key. We are going to work with these five pilot departments this year. The plan is to roll it out to, I think, 12 next year, if possible. And to the rest the following year. So over the NTES, the idea is that it will have more quantifiable indicators for all departments. Not to say that these will replace some of the more qualitative types of information that departments report on what they do, because it's not going to replace it. It's going to be an enhancement, I guess, of what's already in place. And the whole purpose of the pilot is to inform the scope of the following implementation, how it's going to be implemented, and then those target dates will be set out in more concrete terms, because they haven't. We do not have the definite schedule. We sort of have our aims and our goals for what we'd like to see over the NTE year, but it just depends on how
the pilot's working.
And the level of engagement that's going to be necessary with each department to make sure that we set up the system as best we can upfront without too many sort of follow-on reforms and modifications. So that's part of the process that we're pursuing in the pilot. Thank you very much for the questions.
Thanks so much, National Treasury. Both of you. Honorable members, as we might have observed, this takes our responsibility for oversight to another level. We are being reinforced more and more in order to implement our mandate, the Vision Budget Committee. We do appreciate that. And clearly, this is not the end, this is just the beginning. We'll be interacting with ourselves more and more. And as we'll be trying in a way to dovetail what the new information here with our terms of reference from time. Thank you so much again. We break now for tea. Yes, but that's not the end of our meeting. We'll have to continue and look at the expenditure reports with the view of tabling our quarterly report to Parliament.
Thank you.
Can we break now? After 15 minutes, we resume. For the first 3 months of this financial year, with a view of tabling an expenditure report to Parliament by this committee. I'm sure, honourable members, you've got now what seems to be a copy of the report with its limitations, of course. And I'm informed by the Secretariat that there is work in progress to try to sanitize the report so that it does not come across as it is in the present form. Shall we spend some time on this report and then we discuss it, say, in 5 minutes time from now? We shall note also, honourable members, that the suggestions as we made in our last meeting when we considered this report have been to some extent, if not all, incorporated in this report. Honourable member, are you saying something?
No, thanks, Chairperson. I just went through this particular report quickly and said now that it's national departments that will be interacting with around this particular exercise. Ours, I know, in a province is completed. We're tabling a report tomorrow. So that maybe request that maybe I can be released and attend to other business around there.
Thanks so much, honourable member. I take it you are from the Free State Provincial Legislature. It would be fine if you could share also your report with us. Because some of us within a committee where these provincial expenditures are being scrutinized.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's one thing that some of us have been sensitized around different. You know, there's this thing that when NCOP shares a program with us as provinces to say this is a business that you're going to transact. Some of us took interest and attended some of the activities and found that the type of information reported and submitted at national meetings is not the type of information that is reported and submitted at provincial meetings. I know departments fly when they come here. I think two of them, they did not even notice that I was in a meeting in a particular day. When I'll make an example of sports. They then decided to talk lies about the conditional grant when they said they used about 5 million rand to appoint extra people. But while that particular convention has been made out of infrastructure grant, and immediately we went outside, they seen it. Hey, man, we're so confused. You know, they have so many things on the line. But it was unfortunate because as a person who comes and you are new in some of these things, you begin to come, sit down and keep quiet. And Honorable Khalan and Kompela were fighting, but why didn't you say this thing? Because you know them better from a province. But what we endeavor to do is that every time, even the past report, maybe we should send them to you also, so that you can have a sense. It's unfortunate I invited Honorable Khalan, he could have sent someone on the 27th. When we were dealing with the revenue and expenditure reports of municipalities as at 31st March 2007. it paints a picture that is not even nice, but it can also give you a sense at a national level how maybe some of these things can be done so that the work can complement each other's work. But I'll endeavor maybe to make sure that it does not only become maybe the NCOP, because the other ones that we invite in necessarily. Maybe also National Assembly people are looking. Or maybe brought it to be better if we send it to JDC to say, this is our program for the Finance Committee for the year. We'll be dealing with this matter this particular term, this matter this particular time. So that when we also sit and maybe consider reports, even if you send a person to come and have a sense of what is happening in provinces, it will also assist us a great deal.
Thanks so much. This is effective oversight. You know, when you, as a committee, you just move out of the known parameter, a surprise visit or whatever. This effective oversight, you are able to see the hawkers that are sometimes hidden from you. Thanks so much. We look forward in interacting with yourself. Very well. I'm not sure whether our secretariat has got GRC details, Honorable Member. Okay.
We'll be able to communicate our
message. Thanks so much. Please remember you are now a whip.
In the report,
we said earlier on 7 minutes.
Okay.
Now we are taking 1 minute. So,
okay.
To be fair, let's take 10 minutes, Honorable.
Okay, just taking 10 minutes. Is it not wise to find out where some of our members are, because we need that ninth person, like Comrade Sigoni? I don't know.
think
want to kick off.
Yes, you put them
down. Well, first of all, it might really not matter, but I think just for purposes of us going through the report, just some technical points. The Times New Roman as a font perhaps should be used. The researcher just whispered into my ear that in fact this is a size 11 font. It's better if it's 12, then for purposes of complying with the technicalities of compiling the report, then if it's a soft copy, then it's easier for them to effect the necessary changes so that the font is not bigger than 11. That's the first point. The second point is that in respect of the acronyms, this refers to the names of various departments. I know that GCI has got guidelines as to how the names, these acronyms should be written. So you will therefore have lowercase o instead of uppercase o for the Department of Education. Same, I think, applies to housing, just so that those particular things are observed. It is for a reason why the acronyms, the names of those departments as acronyms should be that way. So it's not just the matter of a department deciding to write its name out in that manner. But the other point is, for instance, I think we know the PSC to be the PSC. I think we should refrain from calling it the Office of the Public Service Commission. It's the PSC, Public Service Commission. That's the one point. Okay, the other things are, okay, slightly of a technical nature. You'll see that in the very opening paragraph, we utilize the nation's resources because this does not refer to nations of the world, but our own nation. Therefore, an apostrophe there is necessary. So I thought perhaps in the second paragraph, and of course predominantly, I suppose that's what they meant to say. The second paragraph, it sounds rather clumsy, I may be wrong, to assist the JVC with its work as well as alert the houses to areas of concern. I thought we would rather refer to Parliament and, of course, where necessary, refer to the two houses, etc. Maybe let me not exhaust everything. I've raised those. Yeah, the page 4, I think, spent is in quotes. Does it mean we doubt the integrity of information that refers to 47.7 billion rand, or 23.53% of the allocated budget? The very first opening line there, a review of transfer expenditure. Just a question as to why that is in quotes, 47.7 billion, because that means the so-called or whatever, you doubt it. Yeah, plus other substantive issues, I can have a second bite, let me leave other members to. Honorable Fox.
Okay, person, yes. I would like to make just a general comment, and then with co-chair's permission, I'd be happy to leave my copy behind, because notice that the style in Chairman and page 7 would be an example where you have in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, for this paragraph, you would have 89.97 billion, and in other areas there would be no gap between that, such as in on page 3, in the last paragraph, and so on and so forth. So there's lots of stylistic issues, and if you leave a space immediately after the round, you then get the problem much later on of an R hanging alone at the end of a sentence. So I don't want to go into what I would call the more semantic issues that I have with the report. But a point about certain phraseology. Perhaps the JBC members know what an unrequited payment is. And indeed, we should use that terminology. Don't have a problem. But the House, most members of the House won't know, let alone the South African public in general. So when we do this unrequited payment, there's no harm in just saying, that is, you know, and you carry on with the sentence. Because, of course, we all want to learn more about things as we move along. But Chairperson, on the more substantive points, which I'm now making for the third time, I thought that while we were not going to go in detail on every point, and we can't tackle everything all the time, I agree with that. But for example, on page three in the paragraph, the text just below the table 3, we would say, and this is just an example, GCIS spent the highest 10% by the end of June with expenditure of 70.xyz. And of course that was referring to current expenditure. In the second sentence, there is some slight reason given, like the vacancies. But in that first sentence there about GCIS, it's very, very bold. It's highlighted, it's bold, and I didn't notice it being referred to again. And I think that at the very least, if we're going to make a bold statement like that and we've run out of time to look into the matter, then what we should say is the committee intends pursuing an explanation in the next quarter. We can't just make a bold statistical fact, Chairperson. Let me leave it there for the moment and allow others to come in.
Thank you, Honourable Foster, Honourable Mashiko.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think those are some of the little mistakes that I wasn't going to say something. But I would like to know the F, because on page 3, under transfer, that little explanation whether it's not enough for unrequested payment.
Chair, without entering into a dialogue, I think the Honourable Mashiko is quite right there. But I think we ought to make it very, very clear, when we talk about an unrequited payment, are we talking about any form of a resource, financial or in-kind or anything, or are we talking about a pure financial, or is it accessible, is it concrete, whatever? Because there will be a difference in what an unrequited payment is. So let's make it clear that an unrequited payment is not just does not receive anything directly. What is the anything?
So the Secretary has noted this. Honorable Dambuza and later Honorable Chikung.
Mine is just a correction on page 7. Where is the Department of Safety and Security? That's the last sentence on the implementation of what was location system and arrangement for the payment. It's not payment, it's funding for of the CPF. Payments relate to reserves. but in CPS it's quite funny. And then on housing, I think there's a problem that is omitted there. Problem four.
When we had a concern about
the system, because they seem to be spending less on software.
The last remark was based on page?
Page 90.
Okay. Then, Honorable Mashiko. I'm sorry, Chikunga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, mine is just correction, page 1. Second paragraph, second sentence. I should think it should say in cash flows to assess whether spending is in accordance with. And the last paragraph, second sentence again, says the various portfolios and select committees.
Thank you. Honorable Faj.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of, or perhaps the substantive points here. We refer to capital expenditure, and somewhere along the line, we've also heard a lot about the maintenance and the problems in that regard. It may have been just useful to note the expenditure in the capital expenditure, and indicate that this has a direct link or relationship with allocated maintenance, and there is a figure for the allocated maintenance for that there is. If we don't have the time for that, well then it's something we need to take on board, you know, if we haven't got the time to do that kind of research, as it were. The other point for you, Chairperson, would be something along the lines, page 3, the last paragraph.
My apology. We seem to have lost you in the earlier comment.
Oh, the earlier?
Do you mind just...
My apologies, Chair. It's page 4. There are various references to infrastructure and capital as we go along in the department, but there's a specific reference there. And in particular, if you had to take it across to one of the departments, for example, you would find that education and transport would be of particular pertinence, even if we simply use that as an example to say, in education we have got all of this development, whatever, X has been allocated, the maintenance of X percentage does give cause for concern, or it doesn't, and again in transport, we know perfectly well from the information we've already received that the roads and the bogies, or whatever they want to call rolling stock, in need of maintenance. In other words, the capital investment has not kept pace. I mean, the maintenance has not kept pace with the capital investment. So even if we give one illustration in one of the departments, Chair. Yes.
Thanks, Sarah. Honorable Chair.
Yeah, Chairperson, once again, just on page 6, colleagues perhaps might advise here. I would think that it's much more appropriate to say a department has jurisdiction over XYZ entities instead of oversight. Yeah, sorry. DPE has jurisdiction over those entities rather than oversight, just so that we use the correct terminology.
Okay. Yeah, that's page 6, Chair. Yeah. Honorable Jambos.
This document, I've just received it now, so I'm just grappling. But I don't know whether we have got something that is relating to the concerns of the joint budget that we raised in the last meeting relating to the on transport, no, on safety and security. If we do receive, as they seem to be spending very well, but there was a comment that was saying, do we have value for money? Does the spending commensurate with the funding they receive? I think it is important that we have that comment, because when we are doing our oversight, it has to be clear that we also noted that. Then on the Department of Transport, there was an issue raised about the recapitalization program. I can't find it here. So maybe someone can help me, because I can't find it on this document. And we also raised the concern on the... what was it now? Yeah, the high staff takeover. What we were raised here, we wanted to get the exact which field is being affected most on this, because it might happen that those schools are the ones that are discussed here, we have discussed here on, or it is not reflected on their report. It's just general.
I've noted you, Honorable Foss, but I want us to clarify some of the questions or concerns that you are raising. Are we raising them for the sake of inclusion in the report, or we are raising them so that we send some kind of a query to the department? I think we've got to be clear.
Thanks, Coach. I think firstly, the issues that are raised, because I was just waiting for members to raise them, I have also captured them in my notes that they are the issues that were supposed to be included, and we need to include them. There are others that the members have not yet mentioned, but which I have in my copy included them, that were raised in the previous meeting. Secondly, is that we will make follow-up, which means in our report, we will report to Parliament that on certain issues, for instance, on a high staff turnover, although it will be part of the report, that is our concern, we will indicate to Parliament that we are going to make a follow-up on the high staff turnover. So it will be both ways. That's how I understand. And I think if members, I just wanted to give members the opportunity to ask questions.
Honorable Foss, you were on next in line.
Chairperson, just perhaps some short question of revising it on so on. I'm talking about page 3. It's the last sentence says, considering national departments are ultimately accountable for funds spent, etc., the committee is of the view that the performance and the budget performance. What other performance are we looking at? Would be a little helpful. And the other point here is this one, just the correlation I've written here, Chairperson. It's on page 5, is it? Page 5. It is a reference to capital expenditure again. We're talking of infrastructure, we're talking of capital, etc. All these budgets in the State of Nation address, this whole budget, it's supposed to be a budget that will really promote infrastructure capital and also then lead and feed into an increase in employment, as we know. Now, there is a correlation between capital spending and employment, and we've raised that before. Now, if you look here, so certain of the departments have underspent quite a lot on their capital. And I think at some point, either here under the generic term of capital expenditure, we should make them a statement linking that relationship, so that when somebody reads this, when they see an under expenditure, they'll be alerted to that as a potential risk in the area itself. Chairperson, the one other thing which I think is quite important is what I call colloquialism 6. Page 6 in, under the Department of Education, I don't think we want to talk about the popularization of the teaching profession unless we're going to launch an IDOLS program, you know. I think we've got to look at something a little bit more professional about it. So if we can, I know what we're getting at, but I think we must just add a note of professionalism into that word. And the other point at the bottom of 6, I've raised this before, about the payments to higher education. The committee itself had an issue with this. Why so much to public education, higher education, 95%? And there are very few members in the House, let alone the public, who know that higher education is funded directly from the national budget. That's where its funding stream is, not from the provinces. And we ought to make that. It doesn't give it an excuse. It simply does also indicate what the situation is.
Thank you, Honourable Fox.
Thank you. That's what Ms. Fox has raised. Is that we had the concern because we wanted to know what the department has spent on the development of skills, not necessarily the qualifications, because now what we're talking about, the economy that we have, it's related on the skills that we have. So I think that was an issue on that one.
Thank you, Honorable Peter.
Chairperson, thank you very much. On page 10, 3.1, reference is made there to desired outcomes. Now, going back to the earlier presentation by National Treasury on this framework, the use of terminology there, outcomes is the step in terms of this pyramid that you achieve before impact, and impact is what we aim to change. So I'm not so sure whether we don't want to then employ the correct terminology there instead of saying desired outcomes, because here outcomes is defined as the medium-term results for specific beneficiaries that are the consequence of achieving specific outputs, etc., etc. So impact is much on the result of achieving specific outcomes, as you do from poverty inflation. Sorry. So it seems to me that impact would be much more appropriate than outcomes, because finally that's what we aim to achieve, to change, rather than what we wish to achieve. I don't know if everybody is with me on that one. Just no. So that we try and become consistent.
No, done. Honourable Fox.
On page 9, the last paragraph, it's a query and also a comment. I know we appropriate each department's budget, and then we appropriate the entire budget, of course. But we don't, I would have thought in that, on page 9, the last paragraph, the thought there should be noted that it said that the department's budget, $8.5 billion, was appropriated to that. It was allocated to that department. I think that's really what we meant, rather than a separate appropriation for that particular program. And Chair, the perhaps kind of last thing one would want to make before suggesting any recommendations and so on is to come to page 10, and again, I think when one is very tired or under pressure, one does become colloquial. Just above section 3, we
we talk about the queries, etc., and then the committee opting to write. We took the option, should we, shouldn't we? We took the nice one. We took a decision. We take decisions here. We don't take any of these, stock exchange options. And then it's for the purposes of additional. So all I'm trying to say, Chairperson, is let's try and stick to some very, very tight professional language here. Thank you. Page 10, the last paragraph before section 3. There's a little headline there, and then it says the committee opted. We just simply opted to write. We don't opt. We take decisions. And I think it's important because already this committee has had certain problems because people have said our minutes don't reflect decisions.
Yes, it's page 10. In the absence of further hints, Honorable Mashego.
I'm coming to what Honorable Dikene said about 3.1. Is it 3.1? The use of this desired outcomes, maybe you don't understand it the same way, because according to me, we have an outcome before we get an impact. So according to me, I thought it was right.
Well, I don't see
if you look at this, remember an explanation was made about how this particular framework was put together. Now, we had a presentation by National Treasury, and at the very bottom of that pyramid, you have inputs, and there's the apex there, you have impact. And outcomes comes before impact, and it says outcomes is what we wish to achieve, and impact is what we aim to change.
Yeah.
And so I was saying that isn't it more appropriate that we are seen to be communicating what should necessarily be the logical conclusion of a process, which then should be your impact, because you want to make an impact on people's lives by either reducing or eradicating poverty, etc., etc., as an example. So I'm just guided by, just for consistency, and I don't know, I may be wrong, but just before I thought, I think Honorable Fast has cautioned against us being colloquial and so forth. If you look at the very first paragraph, while spending has continued to improve across government, which is positive, it's like it's more spoken language than written language. So first, let's excise, which is positive, because I think everything else there conveys the correct meaning.
I think both of you are correct. Impact is correct. It's correct. In terms of the recent information we've just acquired. But when we made this, we were still sitting with what is standing outcomes. But in the light of what we've been briefed on, I think what we should say before is impact. For instance, if you had no road, no access road to your home, they come along, they build the road to your home. That's an outcome, you have the road. But if they build a nice road that you enjoy driving on, this is now the impact. So
what we want, what we expect is an impact that will change the lives of the people for the better. An outcome might just what has been produced, which may not necessarily be useful to the people. I think
we have policies in my constituency, but they have not been working for the last year.
But it's an outcome.
When you look at this, you make an assumption that that policy is flushing. That is not working.
Okay. So for you, then, coach.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Well, my approach is that I don't know the report, but I just want to participate on this debate of the outcomes and the impact. Well, for me, I thought that maybe the outcomes, the word outcome here is more appropriate than impact. Because I would think that maybe sometimes if the politicians or self, when you do oversight, when you look at the impact of this delivery, does it make impact from what is happening? Does it make the desired impact? I thought that maybe it's people like ourselves who can come to that judgment, whether it makes the impact or not. I'm not very well quite sure myself, but that's what I'm thinking. I thought that maybe the way it's worded, I'm talking about outcomes, I'm not talking about everything, I'm just talking about outcomes. I thought that maybe this is correct.
Coach?
Yeah, thanks, Coach. Let me remind members that when we discussed in that meeting, we were talking of both outcomes and impact. Our concern was there are no outcomes in terms of the budget that's allocated. And secondly, that at the same time, we are more concerned about the impact. That in some instances where there are outcomes, there's no impact. And I think in this case, we must refer to both. Because we want the outcome, we also want the impact. So, and yeah. But I must take also advantage of the fact that I'm on platform. That I think we will have to rework the last. The third paragraph on page 1. We'll have to rework it. I'm just raising them so that members can agree whether we need to. If they don't, it's okay. Then we also indicated that with the reason why we took the big table to the back of the report was that where we talk about them in the earlier pages, we should indicate to refer to appendix so that somebody, it must come immediately. And I think like on page 2 at the end there, it says table 1, and in brackets it should indicate refer to that appendix. So every time we must keep on, yeah, appendix what. Then also on, I think let me quickly take for some of the things members have raised. Oh yes, on page 6. If members recall that we talked about the SOEs that are loss-making and become parasites. From time to time, they come back, they make losses, they come back to National Treasury for additional funding. And yeah. So we referred to them that we are very concerned about this thing. So I've noted it that we need to include it. And also, what he said will make a follow-up on the Department of Public Enterprises in terms of already they spent 98% of their budget. And we are concerned that where are they going to get money from for the next following month? Yeah, so we said it must be part of the report and we must even ask them that question. Then, yeah, with education, remember that members were concerned that universities are autonomous
74% of the education budget goes to these institutions. But what is the impact of that 74.4% or something percent in terms of ensuring that we have more, we develop more skills? You see, what impact do we get from those institutions of higher learning? So that was our concern, that we've got a problem of lack of skills, but they continue to receive a lot of funding from national departments. We also reflect on page 9, under sports, about the ceiling of vacancies, because we were saying that sports is going to do monitoring for 2010 preparation, and it's got a high percentage of vacant pools. So we must raise it. We must reflect it in our report that it's of great concern, and we are even going to interact with the portfolio committee to make a follow-up, but we are also going to make a follow-up ourselves, so that we are sure that the capacity they say they have, they must, you know, tell us, show us, how do they have that capacity to implement if they don't have, I mean, if they haven't filled the vacancies. And I think the other one is on page 10. Page 10 at the top. I think we will have to rework it. Page 10 at the top. Then the other is when we go to section 3. I'll comment when you come to now. I think even on Home Affairs, we said we must closely monitor the smart card ID spending impact, I mean outcome, as well as future. Because we said that this project has been on the table of the department for many years, and we do not know where we are going to. So that's one of the additional things. But I'll make comments when we come to recommendations.
I don't know if somebody can remind me, but there was something that you mentioned about. But when, what is there in relation to this transferring of the other, what is it, that is transferred to staff now? It has gone out of my mind.
Castle.
Yeah. But there was something that we raised on that one. No, Home Affairs. If you can remind me. Yeah.
Through you, Coach. With Castle, we wanted to know by now, what is the impact on the budget of people who move from other countries? Remember, we were even talking about the Bay Bridge. What is the impact on our budget, on the department's budget, in relation to illegal immigrants? Because we were, although there's something recent that came from the department, but I think we need to continue making a follow-up here.
Honourable Fox?
Yeah, I want to make a suggestion under the education one linked to what has been said by the co-chair. And that is at the bottom of the page there, and I think it will also take our people alongside us, including members of the House in the first instance, because I do think that this the way that we've begun to learn about the pyramid and the monitoring and what this all means, it does give a different nuance to output and outcome. Because 10 years ago, we all just spoke of outputs. Then it was only outcomes. Then it was a combination. Then we said, oh, the impact, the more we learned, you see. Now, with all due respect, as we're moving along with the budget, we need to ensure we take people with us. So I want to suggest that we could utilize the education as an example, you know, the last paragraph. So if we were to say something along the lines of, you know, there may be progress in achieving the outputs of X number of students doing Y, you know, there may be this progress, and the budget spent accordingly. Nevertheless, the question we have to ask ourselves is, in the medium term, what are the consequences of these outputs to achieving X, Y, Z? And it gives us an idea here. Are these more closely related or aligned with the strategic goals in the plan put forward? Because it would appear, you know, when we look at the students coming out or the whatever, you know, or qualified or whatever, there seems we've heard in this house over and over again of the mismatch, which would indicate that we're not achieving the desired impact. Do you see? So we kind of use the example to take people along the road. And I think if we do that in each quarterly report this year, we'll slowly all get a good understanding of what we mean.
And therefore make our report reader friendly, more people getting interested in it. Yeah.
In fact, what the co-chair said reminded me of the workshop that both of us attended just a little over 2 weeks ago. And one of the well-known researchers under Crack on education skills, etc., has made quite a great deal of good research with his colleagues at the Human Sciences Research Council. And immediately when the chair spoke, the co-chair spoke about 74% of the budget being spent on higher education, etc., I thought, and of course correctly so, she mentioned the whole issue of institutional autonomy, but
Institutional autonomy, but we know that it goes also with academic freedom, and sometimes institutions use both institutional autonomy and academic freedom to try and hide away from the need for them to comply with the national imperatives. And just to share with you, one of the slides that he gave us, he said, for instance, between the years 2002-2004, just in the science, engineering, and technology category, graduates as a percentage of total graduates, percentage of total graduates, 2002 you had 200,243, total of said graduates was 26,882, and the percentage share of set graduates was 27. But if you look at it, the growth is very flat. It's 27% in 2002, 2003, 28%, 2004, 27%. So what it does say is that in as much as this input, the resources that are allocated to higher education institutions from, say, the national budget, might have all the good intentions and so forth. And I want to say the higher education institutions might be a little more ingenious and innovative and invoke unnecessarily, in an obstructionist way, academic freedom and institutional autonomy in order not to do enough to ensure that there is no flat growth as we see here. So, I don't know whether I would be right in saying perhaps we might, I don't know whether it can be both or just one of them. The Council for Higher Education, Council on Higher Education and Higher Education South Africa, you know, just to confer with them and make them aware of our existence, and that we are concerned that in as much as these are resources that are allocated, there seems not to be enough progress in this. And of course, it also will involve the Department of Science and Technology, because they support a great deal of programs here, centers of excellence, chairs of research, and so on and so forth. But maybe something that we need to think about, because what the co-chair is saying is indeed important. Thanks, Chair. Sorry to be long. No, thanks. Okay.
Yeah, I think what we agreed on is that on some of the issues, like the one that the Honorable Detail has just spoken about, we will have to have closer interaction with sector parliamentary committees so that we can even understand it from their side, because they make policy, but also sensitize them to our own funding to make it easy that even when we do, we follow up on those either departments or whoever receives funding from the National Fiscal Court. The portfolio committee or the select committee will be taken on board. You know, the other thing that we said, we must, from now onwards, Terence, we must include in our report, is that, remember when we were discussing, we said, to make members more interested in using the E&E documents. From time to time, information that's in the E&E, we must not repeat it in our report. Instead, we must say, refer E&E page so and so, paragraph so and so, so that members can start using these documents. You see, because most of them don't use the documents. So if you look at page, on page 6, there at the bottom, it says a stated priority in E&E. But it said it must be specific that, yes, the page and the number, page paragraph number as well, so that it will be easy for members not to go through the whole page. The person can easily say, oh, it's page so and so and the E&E paragraph so and so, and they can easily read it so that they can use the document. I would propose that we go to recommendations.
Just before that, I think there's one. Okay. Honorable Mashir.
Thank you, Coach. It has to do with some little corrections. If you mention them all, because I think they won't see them. It's on page 5, the paragraph we are talking, the last paragraph on safety and security, to spend its budget, the very first line. What department it has generally managed to spend it, and then, and it's 7, and safety and security. And then page 8, sexual capitalization. I think it's a capital letter R, the last line of that paragraph. And at the last paragraph, if they can rephrase the first sentence, because it's too long, and in light of the concerns over funding, in the light of concerns regarding funding,
and page 9, the last sentence of the first paragraph, we have this recruitment, the last sentence, I think that end has no D, or you can rephrase the sentence again, I don't know.
Thanks, ma'am.
Yeah. Can I make a proposal, members, that technical correction? Let's leave them, because some of paragraphs are going to be reworked, and maybe we can look at the technical when we adopt the report. But for now, as long as the content. We have to get to the content and do to make the necessary changes.
One other issue, honorable members. We've made suggestions to our sister committees. I think we should check where possible to be consistent. In some other issues, we refer to pick up issues and then we say, we will be playing oversight. We'll closely scrutinize that. Instead of saying the relevant sector committee should scrutinize it. Should hear. But we should be, we're dealing with a somewhat sensitive issue here. We must never be seen to be usurping the role of other committees.
Okay, please come on board. Before we go to recommendations.
I would like to respond to some of the things that were raised by members. Firstly, I want to say that whatever that is raised by members, we take it quite seriously. For example, what I've done on my side, there are a number of things that are raised that are not reflected in the report, such as the high staff turnover, recapitalization program, value for money, expenditure on skills development. As staff will provide support to the committee, we take all your concerns that you raise seriously. What I've done is to write to other researchers who are located to this particular committee. For example, I gave to them the copy stating, for example, you find that asking a researcher who is specifically dealing with home affairs to make more research on smart card project, for example, that has been raised. It's not that we're not taking concerns for seriously. We do take those concerns seriously. But I think we have to acknowledge as well that we do have constraints. For example, this is a letter that was written to the chief researcher stating that researchers have to respond by Friday or the latest Monday, since the report is going to be tabled next week. So we're still waiting for those responses. And at the same time, with the report itself, unfortunately myself, I want to see this report now. And at the same time, I'm going to take over as from the 1st of September. Yes, there are standards basically, but there is a problem, and
I think let's talk to you, Kanya. Let's talk to you. You know the reason why we should stop Kaya?
Yeah.
Kaya is still new in the committee. And remember, members, when we introduced him, we said, for this month, Hanif, we agreed with their supervisor that they must work together. Yeah. And the issues that we, even in the next report, Kaya should take it in this understanding that the issues that members say must be included. They are included because, I mean, they want them to be included because we must adopt the report. Whilst at the same time, members understand that there are other processes that are being followed. And if members recall, before he came in, we had a problem that from time to time we would refer to the previous research that interacts with other researchers. And that was not helping me. And it was a big concern to members that, you know, the information that members wanted could not come to the committee. And then, for now, he was supposed to work with Kaya. But what is needed from Kaya is that he mustn't feel that members are hard on him or are hard on parents. That's what I always tell parents. Mm-hmm. That don't think that members are hard on you. We just want the issues to be reflected as part of our report. That these are the things that are being done, and where they have not been finalized, we reflect on the report. So that Parliament, in the next report, they will not be surprised when we refer back to what we have raised in the earlier report, you see. So it should be as simple as that. So I just wanted to... You see, sometimes, maybe the way we raise it, but... they must understand that we want the issues to be there because it's part of our oversight work. And the department must know, even Parliament must know that in our report, we do not just compile the report, but we interact with other relevant stakeholders before we can report to Parliament. Yeah, question.
Thanks for that intervention. Honorable Fox.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I think one could swing this whole thing around. In fact, it's been extremely helpful that we've been informed of this. And I think that in our conclusion, prior to putting the recommendations, as it were, it would be very useful for us to raise those generic issues such as the vacancy issue, the capital and employment, etc., etc. And then in the last sentence, just after two sentences, simply to say that the researcher under direction from the committee has already begun to pursue inquiries from portfolio committee researchers in this regard. So that you acknowledge work being done and you point to the new direction this will take in the next report. You don't have time to put it all in, but we'll do it in the next report.
It's just unfortunate that you were too busy when we had the previous meeting. We said in our coming report, we must, as part of the new development, we must have a section that will report on work in progress, if you remember from me. He said on work in progress. So that before it's either before we go to the recommendations or after the recommendations, so that people know that, yes, indeed, there's an interaction with other researchers, all this. We said we must report on those things so that when Parliament judges us at the end of the year, they would know that these are the things that we have been doing, these are the things that we have said we are going to make follow-up on. We said this is the kind of work that we are doing. Parliament must know what we are doing. So I like it that Honorable Fox is also seconding, failing.
Thank you. All final recommendations now.
I think what I need to raise is that we had a problem, remember, with the responses from the department.
Yes.
So we must, as one of the recommendations, the Parliament must impress upon the department to respond on time to our queries and queries of portfolio committees. So that it's not only us, but they must respond to our queries and queries from portfolio committees. They must, because we've got to report, especially with us, we report within stipulated time frames. So although we'll rework the recommendations, I think that we'll have to rework 3.12, yeah. But the others that we have been mentioning will be included. I also thought that we could, yes, I've tried to interact with Mr. Treasury and we didn't get cash flow, monthly cash flow projection for the year from, of departments, each department. We couldn't get it from National Treasury, and I think we need to reflect it here. That is departmental monthly cash flow projection. Because they make annual projections, but one on monthly basis. So that if you look at their spending, we must also look at this is what the Department of Public Enterprises says they will do. Because the problem, remember, we talked about a 98% spending by DPE. And we don't know whether, as per their cash flow projections, they wanted to spend 98% within the first quarter. So we said we must get them, not the generalized, but per each department. So I think it might be one of the recommendations that we include there. And that we can't escape from this one. That the departments in the last quarter, March, February, March, they spent high spending, and that in the first quarter, low spending. So you must craft a resolution, a recommendation around that one. We link it to the previous report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honorable Park.
Chair, I'm just trying, I think I understand the co-chair
clearly here that we're still going to work on the recommendations, but I wanted to suggest that if we do have any specific recommendations to put down, if we can go ahead and put them down, and that perhaps Section 3 can be, yes, it's conclusions and recommendations, but that we kick off with certain conclusions, as it were. And when I say conclusions, we may want to even choose another word rather than conclusion, about final comment or something, rather than the word conclusion. And then when it comes to the recommendations, I would suggest that we are quite precise. Certainly one of the recommendations I would have wanted to put in regarding vacancies is that there are a number of these departments. Now, we can actually list them. We're aware which ones they are, which say high vacancy rate, high this, high that. There are three or four of them, among others, where we can talk about the following departments, S, A, B, C, should immediately analyze and review their current vacancy profile and furnish a matrix of this analysis to Parliament, because we can't say to the JDC, can we? To the to Parliament 4 weeks after the adoption of this report in the House. 4 or 5 weeks. You don't have, they've got that information. And then the next bullet point to say, indicate what measures are being developed to fill to fill these vacancies in the first instance, and the time frame. 2, what if decisions have been taken to reduce the profile, the personnel profile of the department, can we please have a breakdown of these figures and the levels at which personnel are being employed? So you get a very clear thing. You get the time frame so that you can hold them to this time frame in the second quarterly. And if they do give it back to us a month after the adoption, it means before we adopt the second quarterly, we'll have it.
The issues that she said, so that when we communicate with the department, we state the various categories the honorable member refers to. We want them to be specific. We must be specific in our questions, but they must also be specific in their responses and not be general like they like to be general.
The DG now responding. Honorable Sokoni. Now, Chair, I hear this the recommendation, but from what the researcher was saying, they write letters to department, and department don't respond. And I think that is also covered somewhere in the report, that departments don't respond timelessly. Now, will it be problematic for us, I know that the SLEA committee does that, to sometimes where we think that this kind of expenditure or vacancies is persistent, to invite that specific department to the, what you call it, to Parliament, so that it could explain itself. Because I think that I would suppose that that would kind of expedite our work. I know that there are many departments, but obviously targeting certain departments, as the report says, that you would want to target certain departments. So that because if we, this route, I hear the suggestion of
asking people to respond in 4 weeks' time. But it doesn't conclude our report now. Our report will only be concluded, will only be necessarily conclusive once that report, the department has responded. But I think that it would be much better if the department is invited, comes here, so that at least I think that the report with the input of the department would be conclusive. Thank you, Chair. Making a suggestion.
Honorable Sokon, are you making it for our future report or for this report?
Can I respond on it?
Obviously, Chair, this one, it can be for this one. I'm just talking in future. I'm not talking for this particular report. For future quarterly report.
Question?
Yeah, actually, in the last meeting, we said that we have time constraints to adopt the report, to finalize it. And we are not inviting them. It came up in the previous meeting. But we then said we will identify certain departments for the next quarter and we will call them. But we must continue with formal interaction in the form of letters so that even when they come, we'll base some of the questions on their responses so that we will at least have a lot of issues to raise with them. But we will indicate that for this term, we will invite them in time. We don't want them to say that they don't have information. So we have already agreed in the previous meeting that we are definitely going to call them. And we will give them a chance. You know, we are not going to invite them, you know, within a short space of time. Yeah.
Honorable Chikunda, followed by Honorable Chikunda.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think for purposes of emphasis, or maybe to tighten what the co-chair said about us sending a message to the department to say responses must be timely, I thought immediately of Section 237 of the Constitution under Chapter 14 of the General Provisions, and it says very specifically, diligent performance of obligations, that is Section 237, and it reads, all constitutional obligations must be performed diligently and without delay. So what I am saying is what the co-chair is saying, yes, is important, but perhaps just to demonstrate the gravity of the matter, we insert that particular clause of the Constitution just so that they understand that they are not an entity existing outside of the parameters of the Constitution, and that very section gives us all the power as the National Assembly or a committee of parliament. Thank you.
Let's conclude now, honorable members, this meeting. But before we dispense, there's just something from the secretariat.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd just like to alert the members to the fact that on Tuesday next week, I think it's the 4th of September, there's the workshop on the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Framework. That's the NCOP next Tuesday initiative. Members of the National Assembly component of the Joint Budget Committee have also been invited. I was making follow-up inquiries this morning, and yet I'm not entirely certain what the logistical arrangements are yet. I know that it's at a venue very near the Parliament, and I know that there will be shuttles leaving for Parliament in the morning and coming back during the day because of the joint sitting on Tuesday. So as soon as I have information on that, and obviously I will communicate. I see that there is someone who can pass those more than me.
Yeah, thanks for that. That would the whip would just firm up what I've said. Yeah, no, that's what you firm it up, but there will be those kind of logistical arrangements in terms of transport from Parliament to and from the venue.
which I don't know at this stage. But as for the joint sitting, it has been cancelled. There's no longer a joint sitting. Thank you.
And for that confirmation, I think the secretariat has one more issue that you need to ask. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Just to get clarity from the whip and obviously from the committee, in terms of adopting this report, I understand that it would need to preferably be adopted and tabled in the House and dealt with by the House before the end of the term. So are we talking about a point next week to sit and obviously to adopt the report, or once all the necessary changes have been made?
That's it.
Yes, Chair, it's already according to the schedule. It has been scheduled for a debate. So we really don't have a choice. We need to have this right out of this committee by Friday.
Can I say that the members who... because I thought that we were already preparing to if possible, members. If it will be ready on Tuesday at the workshop, after the workshop, we'll quickly look at it and finish.
Unfortunately, we didn't prepare for lunch.